Linux Luddites, episode 20 for the 21st of July, 2014. Hello and welcome to Linux Luddites, the show where we try all the latest free and open source software and then decide that we like the old stuff better. I'm Joe.
I'm Jesse.
And I'm Paddy. And after the news, in today's show, we have a first impression of StartOS, a hands-on look at Google Glass, your feedback, a quick spin around three environments that maintain the familiar desktop paradigm whilst being lighter than LXDE, and round things off with an interview with Sanal Zukan, the lead developer of one of those platforms. But before all that, I'd like to wish Slackware a very happy 21st birthday for earlier this week, and also find out what Joe's been up to since last time we spoke.
Well, apart from reveling in the victory of my countrymen, the Germans, in the World Cup, not much. Oh, hang on a second. It's not just you, Paddy. Who was that other person?
Afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Not too bad. What are you doing here? Who are you?
Well, I've joined you guys for this show and hopefully a few more following. So I'll be chatting away. I've got a little bit of Linux knowledge, which I hope I'll bring to the show, and we'll see how it goes.
Ah, so what qualifies you to be here then? Presumably you run Gentoo on several servers, do you?
Of course, yeah. I've only ever used SSH. I've got Linux only at home. I've run Mint 17, Mint Cinnamon, and I've been following various podcasts, including yours, and feel I've got enough experience and interest, mostly interest, let's say, in the area to give it a go at one of these podcast malarkeys.
Well, yes, we wouldn't have had you on if we didn't think you were qualified. So here's hoping it works out.
Thanks very much.
Welcome to the team, Jesse.
Thanks, Paddy.
Right, with that then, let's do the news. First up then, the incredibly exciting and just brilliant news that there's a new KDE, KDE 5 or Plasma 5. Oh, I just cannot wait to try it out.
I know some sarcasm in your voice.
Yes, well, what can I say? I'm not very excited, really. It looks a bit better than it was in KDE 4, a bit more polished, but it also seems very slow. In the demonstration videos, you can just see the lag. They're probably in a virtual machine, but even so, it doesn't look good when your flagship video is a bit laggy.
This is the final RC before final release, isn't it?
No. Plasma 5's out properly now. Frameworks 5 was released a couple of weeks ago, and now Plasma 5, the desktop environment's out properly as well. I think as we've come to expect from any .0 KDE release, it does seem quite buggy. I mean, thinking back, it took to about version 4.3 for that series to really settle down. But I'll take exception to what Joe said, because I've actually tried this. I used the daily dev PPA on top of Kubuntu 14.10, and it isn't quick on my box, as nothing KDE is quick on my box, but it is a lot less resource hungry than the 4 series. I mean, I only had occasional fan noise on my box, and it was using a lot less RAM than the 4 series.
Ah, so they have taken some steps in the right direction then.
Yeah, certainly looking that way. I mean, the main thing you'll notice as a user, I guess, is the theming side of things, but obviously underneath the surface the whole lot's been rewritten. But even the theming's a lot better, I think, than it was. I mean, it's a flat graphical look, so it's a little bit Apple-ish, but they haven't messed with any of the workflow features, so if you're used to using KDE it should be fairly familiar instantly. I mean, there's even a new kicker menu for those of us who prefer more traditional menus, and it's looking quite promising, to be honest. I don't think it's going to lure me over to the dark side anytime soon.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is any chance of it luring you away from XFCE?
No, I don't think so. I think it's still a little bit too podgy to run on my hardware, but it's certainly a move in the right direction. And the stuff they've done under the surface, from a convergence point of view, which we'll be talking about a bit later in the show in some other contexts as well, is looking pretty good, actually.
Yeah, a couple of the notes that I saw was the, as you mentioned, the Breeze theme does look a lot more appealing than previous KDEs. And also it's now going to be able to run on HDPI displays, which I think a lot of the, or all of the new desktops are moving towards.
Yeah, and that is the one thing that GNOME's had going for it for a while now, isn't it? It's actually supported high DPI screens a lot better than anything else.
Mm.
So a little bit of competition there. It's always a good thing. Moving on, CentOS 7 has been released not long after RHEL 7.
But unfortunately, only 64-bit, so you have not had a chance to try it with your ancient boxes.
I'm not sure I probably would anyway, but no, it's good to see the community style edition coming out now.
Is it really a community edition anymore? It seems a bit questionable to me, but I tried to try it out and it wouldn't work with unit booting. And so I tried it in a VM and I installed it, and then I was just left with a command line, basically logged in. And then I tried to install XFCE, didn't work. I thought, right, that's enough of that. Move on. So it's probably user error, but I did actually see it running on a laptop at a friend's place, and it looks quite good. It looks very GNOME 2-ish. They've kind of used the extensions and stuff to make it less GNOME 3, and it reminds me a little bit of the early Linux mints that used the extensions before Cinnamon became kind of fully fledged and independent. So I think that they've kind of solved the problem of what to do with GNOME 3, and obviously the last one being GNOME 2, and people not wanting change but also having the features of GNOME 3. So they seem to have done a pretty good job of it, but obviously Red Hat and Fedora and CentOS are just all not for me, really. I'm a Debian guy, so yeah, but it is good to see that CentOS isn't dead, albeit if it is somewhat in the pocket of Red Hat rather than independent like it used to be.
And moving on, there's been a new release of MailNag to version 1.0, which is a mail notification system. It used to be a GNOME only, and now it's desktop independent, so it can work on Unity, etc. It has an account assistant for letting you set up Gmail and other email clients, and it has performance improvements as well.
Why would you ever need something like this when your smartphone just goes bong whenever you get an email?
Your smartphone does that because you're running Gmail, doesn't it? So it's got a nice push thing on. So plenty of people don't have.
I'm obviously joking. If you use a proper email service that you're running yourself, then...
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I'd never come across this until Jesse pointed it out to me. And they have re-architected it to use a plugin system so that sort of extending functionality and broader desktop integration is now a lot simpler. But it seems like a perfectly sensible idea to have sat on your desktop to let you know, unless, of course, you don't like being distracted all the time.
Yeah, I remember the days when I used to go home and check my email, whereas that's just sort of a distant memory now. It's just whenever I get one, I get one. I suppose the only equivalent is when I wake up and turn my phone off airplane mode and get a load of spam and whatever.
But this does deliver it straight to your desktop rather than having to have a tablet or a phone around the place, and so it must work better for people who are, you know, desktop all the time.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I have a lot of different email accounts, so it would be quite useful for me on the desktop if I didn't have a smartphone. So I suppose good for Luddites. But more exciting news, and that is that there now is a Raspberry Pi Model B Plus, which has got two more USB ports, better power management, one port for audio and analog video, and not much else as far as I can see.
They have moved it around a bit to keep it square within the board rather than extending over the edges, which and added some more better placed holes for mounting it, which may improve its ability to be used in smaller projects.
Yeah, and they've rounded the edges for that old-fashioned look now.
Yeah, yeah.
All of which, of course, means it won't fit in existing boxes.
Well, it never would have anyway because of the two extra USB ports, so I suppose that was probably their motivation for thinking, well, let's correct the mistakes we made on the first one and just totally redesign the layout of it because you're going to need a new case anyway. But at least they are still making and shipping the old ones for customers who have designed products that it fits in a specific way. At least they've not kind of stuck two fingers up and said, this is the new one, like it or lump it, like certain other companies would do.
Yeah, and they've kept the price the same at $35. And also, although you've got additional GPIO pins there, there's 40 now as opposed to the original 26. The 26 that were there originally still work, so they've kept the original layout for those and just got additional ones. So it seems like a reasonable step up.
Yeah, I mean, some people wanted a new version with a newer version of ARM and all the rest of it, but this is fully backwards compatible and just a bit better. So it seems that they've kind of done it right, really, which isn't a huge surprise because they've pretty much done most things right, apart from needing binary blobs for graphics drivers, but let's not get into that. But yeah, it seems to be good news all around.
Agreed. If they've made a Raspberry Pi that I can plug my Wi-Fi USB dongle into without it rebooting, then that's good by me.
You need a better power supply, man. Get a tablet one or a powered hub, maybe.
powered hub, yeah.
Well, still on the theme of small devices, we'll talk about mobiles a little bit. And there was an article came out that was from Avast, and they were trying to sell you their secure wiping software by pointing out that wiping Android phones isn't necessarily always as effective as you might imagine. Now, that's kind of a fair point, and the story even made it into the UK press.
Is it fear-mongering, or is it really true? I mean, they were using just off-the-shelf software. It wasn't any specialist stuff to recover these files, and they recovered quite a lot of personal data.
They did, yeah. I mean, it seems that some implementations of the Android factory reset merely mark the disk as unused, so any disk recovery tool can actually fish your data back out again. Now, obviously, Avast are actually trying to sell you their service. I mean, there are a whole load of other products in the Play Store that can do secure wiping. I mean, the most effective one that's free of charge and easy to do that I've seen people suggest is to actually encrypt your phone and then do a factory reset, because without any of the keys and things, you won't be able to gain access to anything.
I mean, obviously, I played musical tablets with Nexus 7s for a while, so, and each time I signed into my stuff and had all my emails and everything, so reading this, it put the fear of God in me, really. I was thinking, oh no, I hope someone's not got all of my emails and passwords and everything. So it was quite worrying. But then again, you'd have to be specifically looking to do this, which obviously Avast did. They bought these phones off eBay and then ran the software on them. But the average person that you sell it to on Gumtree or Craigslist in America or whatever is presumably going to just boot it up, immediately sign into their own email and start browsing and installing apps and everything. So it is a worry. But then again, do you want to spend your whole life worrying, or do you want to spend your life trying to have some fun?
Well, you're talking about fun. They only bought 20 Android smartphones, and there were 250 male selfies, which that wasn't the point, was it? Hell, minute.
including a few nude ones as well, which is quite funny. Who takes pictures of themselves naked?
What I can't understand is 250 nude male selfies out of 20 smartphones. This is a ridiculously high proportion.
I suspect it was all on one of them.
Yeah. Anyway,
one
sorry.
One very vain person.
Flicking back to the point, I do wonder whether or not Avast would have come out with this had they not had their own app for wiping Android phones. Would they have done it for the very love of telling the community what they should be doing, or did they just wait until they brought out an app which could do it for you and they can sell to you?
Don't be so cynical. Of course they'd do it for the good of the community. It's not like they only want to make money. No, I mean, it seems very clear to me that's why they did it, just to sell their app, just to put the fear of God into people like me. And slightly less techie people might think, oh, right, next time I sell my phone and upgrade or whatever, I'd better do this and I'd better buy the application rather than looking around for a free alternative. Or, as Paddy said, something as simple as encrypting it first.
Yeah, before Android and iOS, etc., improved their factory reset facilities.
You think it'd be pretty straightforward to do it. But I always assumed incorrectly that it was a proper wipe, but obviously not. That said, I wonder how many of these phones had SD cards in them that hadn't been wiped, and maybe that's where they got it from. And so they're kind of saying this on a technicality.
Yeah, it doesn't define that in the article, does it? So maybe that's where they've got them from.
You never know.
So Spotify have moved 5,000 of their servers from Debian over to Ubuntu. They've cited that the reason for this is for the predictable release cycle and long-term support by Upstream, which goes to put pressure onto Debian to wonder whether they should be providing a long-term support.
Which is something we've talked about on previous shows, because they're actually attempting to do that on an early release, aren't they? And with the possibility of moving it forwards for future releases as well. Which would be very welcome, I think, long-term support for Debian.
It seems odd that Debian doesn't have a long-term support. It's considered one of the more stable operating systems of Linux, and it doesn't have a long enough long-term support to allow companies like Spotify to use it for the length they want to.
I must admit, I'm still chafing a little bit. Last time I saw Spotify and Debian in the same sentence was a few months back when they were writing letters to all and sundry saying that Debian should adopt Systemd, which obviously they did eventually. And I'm not sure how much their intervention played out in that decision, but it can't have helped any.
Well, maybe when Canonical came out and said that Ubuntu was moving to Systemd, they thought, right, that's it. Now we've got Debian to use it and they've got Ubuntu to use it. Let's move over.
You mean they spotted a two-stepping stone strategy to moving over to Ubuntu? That seems fairly long plan for a company like Spotify, in my opinion.
Seems a little unlikely, doesn't it?
Don't get me started on Spotify. Cannot stand it. Just use Grooveshark. That's my tip. Although things are fast at disappearing from that.
Well, moving on then, and I think Joe was going to talk about this story, which I will take away the pleasure from him.
Ah.
Oh, go on. You do it then.
Yes. Remember on Mintcast when I said that I don't foresee there being a high-end Tizen smartphone anytime soon, and then the day after I recorded that, and therefore before the show was released, Samsung came out and said that they were releasing one in Russia, and I had egg on my face. Well, needless to say, I'm having the last laugh because it's been postponed indefinitely. Yes, I was right.
And the reason for the postponement?
Apps, basically. The fact is that Russian carriers are not going to sell phones that have no app support.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was amazed by the guy from Samsung trying to make a positive out of that, saying that if you did develop apps, they'd be sort of highlighted very high up in the Play Store or their equivalent of it, simply because there's nothing else there.
That was, he needs some lessons in marketing speak and buzzwords, I think, because that was just really terrible thing to say, wasn't it?
But doesn't this have something to do as well with Google and Samsung becoming closer partners? Because Samsung was always moving away from Google in the software side of things, and Google have, as far as I can see, wrapped their knuckles a little bit, and Samsung have now agreed to be more pure Android and less dabbling with it, fiddling around, or indeed jumping ship over to Tizen, so that Google will continue to use Samsung hardware.
Well, that was my understanding. Yeah, that's why I made that point on Mintcast, because it was my understanding that Samsung are going to stick to hardware and Google are going to stick to the software. And that's why Google got rid of Motorola, and why Samsung hopefully will stop shipping TouchWiz and similar software, or indeed making their own software like Tizen. But then I was proved wrong, but now it seems that I've been proven right. So who knows what's going on with these huge organizations? The wheels of bureaucracy inside them turn very slowly, and maybe it was announced by one department that didn't get the memo that, hang on, no, we're not actually doing this anymore. And maybe it isn't about the fact that the Russian carriers didn't want it. But who knows? I mean, it does stand to reason, the official story, doesn't it, that they were ready to release it, and then the likes of Orange and T-Mobile or whatever, whoever it is in Russia, said to them, look, you know, no one is going to buy these phones, apart from a few geeks who want to develop on it.
So they've been caught at the very first hurdle of the number of apps on your ecosystem and the number of people that use it, which is something that Microsoft's been trying to slog away at, trying to improve the number of apps on its ecosystem so that people come to use it. It's a bit chicken and egg, and Samsung haven't waited for the egg to hatch.
We don't like that analogy, because clearly obviously eggs were around before birds, even, because of dinosaurs, and even the anyway, let's not go there. But yes, it is this vicious circle, isn't it, of we don't have enough apps to warrant people buying it, and if people don't buy it, then we're not going to develop enough apps for it. So the way to do it is to try and do it in a more grassroots way, like Firefox tried and failed with Firefox OS, in my opinion, of put out some developer phones, get some developers interested and engage with them, build a community, try and get some at least basic apps going for it. And then hopefully when it's ready to cross over into the mainstream, there's going to be at least a baseline number of apps available, rather than there being essentially none with Tizen. So it just seems to be a completely incorrect strategy to me, but it would tie in with the fact that they're not really looking to use Tizen on smartphones because of the Google thing.
Well, moving on then to something else that's hardly used by anybody, and that's Microsoft Bing, which apparently has 2.5% market share for search in Europe.
What, you mean Bing that I use every day?
That'll be the one. And the story is that they've followed Google down the track of offering Europeans the right to be forgotten.
And we've somewhat clashed about this, haven't we, before, about whether there's any point with it. And one of my main arguments was, well, it's available on Bing. So that's kind of crumbled before my eyes. So I don't know. It just seems a bit pointless. But I suppose if you're not on Google or Bing, there's only really Yahoo left in the mainstream. So if they take the results out, then you are essentially forgotten. So maybe it is possible to be forgotten on the internet. But and I still don't know how I feel about that. Maybe if I had something that I wanted to be forgotten, my feelings would be different. But it just feels an awful lot like Winston's job in 1984. I mean, that's almost a Godwin-like thing to refer to 1984. But it kind of, am I wrong in thinking of that when you think of deleting things from the internet? It is basically historical revisionism.
But the people argue that it's not deleting it from the internet, it's deleting how to get to it from the internet. However, I do agree with you that if Google, Bing, et cetera, all prevent you from finding items on the internet, then there is no real way of finding that item unless you search every single website, which is just not practical. But I'm right in saying that Microsoft have taken this upon themselves to implement Europeans' rules, because I thought the European Parliament requested only Google to stop people from finding stuff on the internet. I didn't realize it extended to all search.
No, it was across the piece, but of course Google, with the amount of traffic it gets, is also getting all the publicity. And what's interesting, I think, is just before we started recording this, I saw an article saying that the Data Protection Advisory Board for Europe met on Tuesday this week to work out how removal requests would be dealt with and should be dealt with by all these organizations. And they're going to be sitting down with the likes of Google and Microsoft to try and firm up some guidelines, which is something that's been notable by its absence so far.
In a previous episode, I remember you'd noted that Google was being quite frivolous with its takedowns because it hadn't had any guidelines as to what was and wasn't required. And so it was making up itself to almost throw it in the face of the European Parliament as to how silly this ruling was. So it's good to hear that someone's actually clamping down and making sure that there is strict guidelines as to what should and shouldn't be there, and maybe this will be a more sensible decision rather than currently Google taking everything off that anyone requests.
And as we mentioned, the right to be forgotten was something that originated in Brussels, and the next story also kind of originates in Brussels, doesn't it?
So this is a story that MPs in Britain have voted through some emergency legislation giving the security services access to people's phone and internet records. And it was a cross-party agreement, which actually got moved through the lower chamber in one day. It seems incredibly odd to me that they can get something this major through so quickly without any consultation or wider envelope of discussion. So this is almost seems like the things that GCHQ have been doing behind the scenes, but just made public and everyone has to agree with it. You have no choice. You will have your phones accessed. You will have internet records accessed. And it seems very odd to me that this hasn't been the number one headline.
This is the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Bill, otherwise known as DRIP. And as I alluded to earlier, this is down to Europe originally. I mean, the European Court of Justice ruled in April that an EU directive requiring phone and internet companies to retain communications data was actually not valid and should be struck down on the grounds that it infringed human rights. And the response of a lot of governments around Europe, including our wonderful benevolent dictators here in the UK, is, as Jesse said, to push some things through on emergency measures to just re-legalise exactly what they were doing before, and generally, as is the case in the UK, to actually extend that remit as well.
I think it's quite telling that our Home Secretary, Theresa May, said, "This bill merely preserves the status quo. It does not extend or create any new powers, rights or access or obligations on communications companies that go beyond those that already exist." So it is just shoring up the legal framework for what they're already doing right now. So I don't think anything's really going to change because of this. It might get a little bit worse publicly, but come on. Call me tinfoil hat, but even long before Snowden, it was quite clear that somewhere everything that you do online or with your phone is being logged for one reason or another, ostensibly for terrorism, but just because why not? If you've got the capability to do it, then you're going to do it. And they say that phone calls themselves aren't actually going to be logged, but who are they trying to kid? Am I really being tinfoil hat here? I mean, I could start going crazy with this and saying that clearly this was all agreed at Bilderberg or whatever, but I won't, although I already have. But come on, I'm not crazy, am I?
No, I don't think so. And even if they claim they're not logging all of the records of communications and what your email says, it's well known that all you need to do is log who's sending packets to who and at what times and who's within their network and how do those networks interact for them to make a fairly good picture of the communities and groups that they're trying to keep an eye on. And actually what they're saying may not be the point of what they're trying to get. It's just the metadata of what's going backwards and forwards and understanding who's having the communication. So even if what she's saying is true, which I agree with you, Joe, is unlikely, even if what she's saying that they are not recording every phone call, every email, they're still recording the data, the metadata within that to see who's talking to whom. And that's really where part of the problem is.
Well, from extremely serious news to extremely trivial news, and that is that Amazon Prime Video is coming for Android. I cannot even muster a single care about this, I'm afraid. It was formerly called Love Film, and I didn't care about it then. And I don't know why I've got an irrational hatred of Amazon. It's not because of their tax business. I just don't like them. I don't like the way their site works. Don't like the Kindle stuff. I just don't like Amazon, so I just don't care. So do any of you care, or should we move on?
I have to admit, I was surprised when I read this because I assumed there was already an Android app for it. I don't use Amazon Prime or Amazon Video, and so this came as news to me that there wasn't one, and now there is one. So is that news?
I think probably it's for guys in the UK, or guys and gals in the UK, I should say, because we don't really have the option of watching Amazon Prime using Flash, which people in the States can do. It isn't an issue for them at all, but the UK version of Prime doesn't support Flash and has basically been something that we can't access at all, those of us who use Android.
And isn't it Silverlight as well? So you basically can't use it on Linux generally. So if you don't use Windows or OS X, you're just out of luck.
Absolutely, yeah. And for those of us who like catching up on very, very old episodes of Games of Thrones, very, very old episodes of Game of Thrones or Silk, another personal favourite of mine, but there you go. Yeah, it's quite good news, really. I mean, I don't use Netflix. I'm not a member of Netflix, but I am a member of Amazon Prime, so it would be very handy indeed to have the option there.
Do you have a large tablet to watch these on?
No, but I'd pipe it through to the TV on HDMI cable would be the plan.
Yeah, that'd be a useful way of putting this into action, yeah.
A TV? What's that?
Yeah, we've heard all this before. Should we move on
then? That thing I don't own. Yeah, okay.
Big black box in the living room.
Yeah.
No, I don't have one of those, I'm afraid.
Okay, let's move on to a whole bunch of things that are related to Chromebooks or that sort of ilk. And the first story is that Dell, they're actually halted sales of their Chromebooks to consumers.
Yeah, they've sold so many of them that they can't keep up with demand. So they are prioritizing their business customers rather than just consumers, which is kind of good news for Chromebooks, isn't it? More good news for Chromebooks. It just seems that no one is really interested in laptops anymore, traditional ones. Or should I correctly say, no one is interested in Windows anymore. Since Windows 8, obviously loads of people have had to buy them and people have had to put up with 8 and 8.1. And now there's talk that the next version is actually going to have two different versions rather than this forced convergence where you can actually boot to desktop and have a start menu. But people are just over Windows, aren't they, consumers? Or at least that is the feeling that you get from reading the news, that people don't want this horrible virus-ridden, spyware-ridden, bloated system that slows down. They just want to turn something on and use it, like their iPad or their Android tablet or a laptop that just works and lets them get on Facebook and buy things on eBay and check their email. And it just seems that every single story to do with Chromebooks backs this up, this idea that people are just sick of Windows and want something cheap and fast and good.
Yeah, it seems to be an incredibly well-played piece of timing by Google to have brought out Chrome. I know when it first came out, there was a lot of laughs from the tech press at such a cloud-only operating system and such lightweight, and it couldn't do this and it couldn't do that. But the combination of people talking badly about Windows 8 and the people talking highly about Chrome OS means that I think public opinion has, you know, very much ignored what the big players are saying and ignored what they've previously done. And they've converged on this idea that actually, if all I need is to open up a laptop and type my post into Facebook and search something on Google, a Chromebook is quicker, simpler, as you say, virus-free, whereas the Microsoft option is far more expensive, far more complicated, bloated, not understandable, and it's not something that the average consumer is happy with. So I think a couple of years ago, Chrome OS was a little bit laughed at when Windows 8 was announced, but now it seems to be exactly the other way around, and it's, so as far as I can see, very much a grassroots thing, that it's been word of mouth, reviews on Amazon, both positive for Chrome OS, negative for Windows 8. And so it's got to this position where Windows is not a tenable solution for such an expensive piece of hardware and such an awkward operating system, but Chrome OS is.
Yeah, and as both of you have mentioned, Microsoft seem rather worried about this, and they're now working with partners like HP, or they're certainly attempting to work with partners, to push out price-competitive laptops.
Yeah, but they're going to be running these really slow processors that are just not going to cope with Windows. I mean, you can push out a machine with a really low-powered processor and not much RAM if it's running a slimmed-down Linux-based operating system like Chrome OS, but if you try and throw Windows on it, it's just going to be a disaster. Like with the netbooks, that even running Linux, some of those were a little bit dodgy, but trying to run Windows, I mean, where the original netbooks came with Linux, and then they started coming with XP, but then Vista came out, so they came with that. And I don't know if you guys have ever tried using one. It was just a disaster. So I don't think that Microsoft can compete with Chromebooks with their current operating system. And this idea of it having to be backwards compatible, at least after a fashion, with legacy software, it's just not going to work. If they want to target low-powered machines that they can sell cheaply, then they're going to have to rewrite their entire operating system. And that's just not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, it's highly doubtful. I mean, the reason I was slightly attracted to this idea, there seems to be a race to the bottom going on, hardware costs between Microsoft and Google. And that's got to be good news for those of us running Linux, because it's bound to make picking up a decent spec portable a lot cheaper for us.
Well, is it though? Because obviously you've got the UEFI business with the Windows laptops and Chromebooks. Yeah, it is possible to hack them. And you've done that, Jesse, haven't you? Or at least tried to.
Yeah, my Chrome OS also has Linux on it. It's got XFCE version. But the problem is that it's on top of an ARM PC. So I've got the HP 11. And while a lot of programs will be installed on it, you still can't get everything. And so I feel that I would not suggest that someone buys an ARM-based Chromebook to then try and use it to run Linux, because you just don't have the full suite of what Linux offers. Whereas maybe one of these Celeron processor ones would be able to do that, and it would be a better option. So I think that maybe what Paddy was saying is true. You could get a low-end hardware, get rid of the Microsoft stuff, Linux still boots straight through UEFI these days, so it seems that's not an issue, and then you have a fairly cheap, acceptable-to-run Linux piece of hardware, whereas with Windows, like you say, it's a bit bloated. Chrome OS, some of the hardware isn't quite ready for Linux to be put on it.
Yeah, I suppose it is ultimately good news for consumers, and anything that drives prices down has got to be good, because you know that they're making massive amounts of profit on them, and obviously making them for a fraction of what we're paying for them. But there's even more bad news for Microsoft, at least in the US, and that's that Lenovo is stopping selling small screen Windows tablets there. And in this case, small screen referring to 7-inch tablets. The larger ones are still doing reasonable business there, but they're kind of moving their stock around and trying to dress it up as supply and demand, and, oh, we've got loads of demand for it in other territories. But to me, I think it's just them sort of cutting their losses and selling them for a lot less in developing markets than they wanted to in America, because people just don't want a Windows tablet. I mean, who in their right mind would want a Windows tablet?
Yeah, you look at the current Windows release, the most recent one, and they've been touting their new tablet with the keyboard, and that's not a tablet anymore. That's a small screen you can detach from a keyboard. But if you're only going to be using it with a keyboard, you've basically got a laptop with a detachable part, which I don't think is what we really want. You want either a tablet or you want a laptop.
No, I want a phone or tablet with a slide-out QWERTY keyboard, please. That old chestnut.
Well, despite Lenovo going down this road, I mean, I recently read a Paul Tharrott piece saying that, quote, dozens, unquote, of Windows-based mini tablets are in the works from a number of manufacturers. So I guess we're going to have to wait and see how that pans out, but I share your scepticism a little bit. There are a couple of things struck me about this story. I mean, the first one is that there are no licensing costs for Windows on devices under 9 inches or less in size. So it doesn't cost the manufacturer anything to use Windows as opposed to, say, Android on one of these devices that's less than 9 inches, which kind of says something about the state of play when, even with a free-to-use operating system, they can't make a go of it.
Yeah, and you could argue that with laptops, Windows is the name people know, and so they want to advertise them as, oh, this comes with Windows. But now with a tablet, Windows, is that really the name you know? Well, it's not, is it? Android, or obviously an Apple with a bite taken out of it, is what people want to see on their tablets.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing I found interesting about the story and the wider picture slightly, is how different companies are approaching things in this market space. I mean, Google, as you say, have got Android for phones and tablets, and Chrome OS for proper computers, if you like. And Microsoft has got their phone OS for phones only, and is trying to scale Windows 8 down from both desktops and laptops to the tablet market. And both companies seem to be acknowledging that a single OS and desktop environment simply doesn't make sense across all those multiple form factors. So where does that leave Canonical?
Oh, poor Canonical. Where does it leave them, eh? Out in the cold.
But Canonical's idea is to have the same background technology, the same coding, but then have different fronts to it for the different sizes. That was my take on it. So you have Unity, as you'd expect, on the desktop, and then a smaller version for maybe a 10-inch, and then a simplified version for the phone, whereas these ones look like, for example, the Metro, or formerly Metro interface, was trying to have exactly the same interface for all three. But I think convergence from Canonical's point of view is the same background information, the same software, but the front will look different. And that's where they're trying to go with convergence. It's the impression that I get, whereas I can fully understand why Microsoft has failed at this point, because you can't have the same interface for all three size items. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, but neither Microsoft nor Google are using the same, what you're referring to as background. They're not using the same OS underlying any of these products either, are they? I mean, that was the point I was trying to make, was it's not just the interface side of things, it's the whole software stack. And we talked about convergence on the show a few times, and I mentioned that Popey wrote in last time, sort of trying to correct me a little bit. I mean, my understanding is exactly as you say, it's a whole stack there that they're looking to be malleable enough to move across all these platforms, which seems to make sense. But if Google can't do it and Microsoft can't do it, it just kind of gives me a little bit of doubt that maybe Canonical could do it.
I feel a famous Joe prediction coming up.
Well, I've said before that Canonical have been too upfront and have tried too hard to, okay, not tried too hard, but they've announced it too early that they're going to do this convergence thing. Whereas Google have never, ever, as far as I can see, said anything about convergence. They've never publicly said that. They've just slowly done it through the totalitarian tiptoe method of just a little bit here, a little bit there. And one day we're going to suddenly realize, hang on, we are in a time where Google is convergent across every device. You know, I can get my Gmail on any device. That's one step of convergence. Whereas just trying to go at it hammer and tongs like Canonical have with Ubuntu, to me, seems the wrong approach. You have to do it by stealth and through tiptoes rather than what Canonical have done, basically. So you're not going to get any more predictions about Canonical going away. I don't want to upset Popey just in case he's listening.
But you're right, though. I mean, the key thing, I think, for users in convergence, if I use the word convergence in quotes, isn't about the OS. They don't care about the OS. To some extent, they don't even care about the desktop environment looking the same. And the point about Google and Microsoft here is they have got different underlying OSs. They've got different desktop paradigms going on. As you say, it's the Gmail, it's the apps, it's the services that sit on top of that and the convergence that's occurring at that level that is what's really important to people and people find valuable. It isn't the actual underlying software stack.
Well, another technology that I won't be using because I don't use Chrome is Chrome Remote Desktop for Linux, which Google have launched for Linux, at least in a beta. So obviously I don't use Chrome, I haven't tried it out, so someone tell me about it.
I don't think there's a huge amount to say other than what you have done already. It's been available on Windows and OS X and Android, and now finally Linux is going to get it too. I mean, there's a lot of competing products out there, so I guess the newsworthiness of this story, if that's such a word, is really, again, that Google is going for ubiquity and it's looking to cover all the platforms, which is something you touched on earlier. And I guess while I'm thinking about that, it'd be really nice if they got the fingers out and finally released a version of Google Drive for Linux.
I'm looking forward to having Drive on Linux natively. I think that's something where Google should really step up. But rounding off this final item on the Chrome OS and Chromebooks generally, it appears that Google have announced a experimental handwriting recognition mode. So you can now try writing on the on-screen keyboard and it will change that to text. Anyone going to use this?
Well, call me cynical for once in my life, but isn't it just quicker to type even with an on-screen keyboard? I mean, it's just a bit of a novelty, isn't it? Handwriting recognition. I've never seen it work brilliantly. Well, okay, I've seen it work brilliantly, but I've never seen it work perfectly. And I've never seen it work as well as obviously a hardware keyboard. That's a pipe dream on mobile devices. But a decent keyboard application, like I use SwiftKey, for example, which a lot of the features from which have been stolen and put into the Google keyboard. But it's just a bit of a novelty, isn't it?
Agreed. And from what I can see, it only works on touchscreen OS devices. So that would only be ones that have the higher end of the Chromebooks, if you will.
That's what I thought was interesting about the story. I mean, does this possibly indicate that Chrome OS may be actually coming to a tablet sometime soon, as opposed to a more traditional form factor laptop?
Well, obviously the Pixel, the Chromebook Pixel, is touchscreen. And maybe they'll go that way, like with laptops like my VivoBook that are a laptop with a touchscreen. Maybe they'll kind of sneak it in that way. But, I mean, you, Paddy, have been predicting for a while that Chrome OS and Android are essentially going to converge at one point anyway. So maybe this is a hint towards that.
Yeah, it certainly isn't a nice way of using a screen to have to reach out in front of you and swipe your hand all over it. So it would be a lot more native if you had it just on a tablet held in one hand, like you're writing on a pad.
Unless you had a laptop that had a touchpad that was capable of things like handwriting recognition.
Yeah, but how big is the biggest touchpad?
Well, good point. I think I could do handwriting on my touchpad on this laptop on my 15-inch one, but yeah, I suppose reasonable point. Although even on the MacBook Airs, I know that Paddy has never even seen one of those where he lives. They don't have them there. But that's got a pretty big touchpad that you could probably do it on just about.
Yeah, as long as you only speak in words that are less than 10 letters or something.
Maybe.
All right, enough rat-holing, gentlemen. Let's move on to the final story of this show's news. And that's about the Apple and IBM get-together, which you've probably read about. And IBM will be pushing Apple phones to corporates with IBM software installed, and Apple will be providing the support. Now, I think this is quite a big story, but there seems to be a little bit of dissent amongst our ranks. So tell me, Joe, why don't you rate the story?
Well, I don't care about Apple. I don't care about IBM. So why should I care about this?
Isn't that a little bit of a fingers-in-the-ear approach?
Well, that's my style, man. What can I say?
Well, let's think about who's going to lose out, shall we? I mean, the people who are going to lose out straight away from this that I can see is Microsoft for one, because they're going to be losing Surface sales, which obviously you don't care about. Samsung, who use Linux in their phones, will lose corporate phone sales. BlackBerry may as well just give up and go home, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
SAP and Oracle will probably be impacted in their core businesses as well, which, again, is a Linux-related issue. And I think it's going to be a huge setback for Google, who have been busily adding features to Android to make it a more bring-your-own-device-friendly platform. And this has really just cut the ground straight from underneath them.
Well, you say that, right? But look at Google's track record and look at Apple and IBM. Now, one could argue that Apple hardware and software is premium quality and therefore demands a premium price. And ThinkPads, which IBM used to make, and other IBM hardware is premium quality and premium price. Whereas Google have always been about making everything free or as close to free as they possibly can. Look at the Nexus range of phones and tablets, dirt cheap. Look at Chromebooks, dirt cheap. So essentially, I see more of a split here where you've got the high end on one hand and then the lower end on the other. And depending on how established a business is, how savvy they are, how much cash they've got, it depends on which way they're going to go. Are they going to go for probably this expensive combination of Apple and IBM, or the cheaper option with Google? I mean, Microsoft, as far as I'm concerned, are essentially moribund at this stage. Obviously, maybe moribund is the wrong word because they're not close to dying, but they are. The ship has started to turn, you know, the oil tanker has started to turn, and it's going to be a while before they actually go away, but they're on the wane, aren't they? So I think that startup businesses are more likely to go the Google route where things are cheaper, whereas businesses with a bit more money behind them and more trust in the likes of IBM are more likely to go that way. So I don't think that it is necessarily a bad thing for Google. I think it's just sort of divergence within the market.
I think it's certainly that, but I think also that it's a pointer of things to come, really. I mean, a lot of these companies that we've mentioned earlier in the news are trying to increasingly cover all the bases, either on their own or through non-competitive partnerships like this Apple-IBM deal. And I think there's likely to be a lot of blood on the carpet going forwards. I mean, in few non-tech sectors do you see more than two or three dominant players, for instance. And that's because corporate capitalism tends towards monopoly, but that's abhorred by consumers and regulators alike. So instead we get a near cartel-like situation with a handful of entities appearing to compete, but really whose shared goal is preventing new entrants from upsetting their profitability. And I don't see any reason to expect the tech industry to be any different. So I'd expect to see more of these partnerships over the coming years, and eventually that'll lead to some mega mergers and maybe an endgame of maybe two or three tech titans who basically control the whole worldwide IT infrastructure in a few decades.
Yeah, and Canonical are going to be right up there with them, eh? Oh, I just couldn't resist, sorry.
Well, someone from Apple needs to sort out their PR because they have the catchy title between the two of them of the IBM Mobile First for iOS Solutions, which, given that normally it's iPhone, iPad, I this, I that, you'd have thought it'd have had a better title than that.
Yeah, they surely should have just lowercase the I in IBM.
Ba-boom. Well, as the Chinese would say, we live in interesting times. So let's move on from the news and talk about a few things we've seen elsewhere that we just want to cover very briefly. Now, I saw eBay's Q2 earnings when they came out recently. And I don't want to talk about the earnings. What I want to talk about is the data breach, which we mentioned on a show and commented on the lack of press coverage, tech press coverage about this. And I've seen absolutely nothing since.
Well, I've kept using them, and so they've made loads of money out of me, so it's not really a surprise. Even I'm quite aware of what they did and with their ambiguity over hashed versus encrypted passwords, and I'm still using it. So what can you say? It's not a huge surprise, is it?
It's not a huge surprise. I just find it deeply disappointing that nobody who calls themselves a journalist out there has actually got anywhere. I don't even know if they've tried to get anywhere digging to actually find out what the whole story is here. As far as us poor punters are concerned, it's just dead and buried and never happened.
Yeah. Well, we'll never let it go. So an interesting one that you put in about speeding up data storage by 1,000 times with spin current using lasers and technology that's 5 years away, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, it is a speculative piece. It was a press release from the University of Technology in Eindhoven, and they were talking about how storage density has increased massively over the years, but the access speed to that data stored on a hard disk hasn't really increased very much. And they're talking about using lasers and a special setup to actually get a 1,000-fold speed increase, as you suggest. And I just thought people might be interested to read the very short press release they'd put out, and could be a technology worth keeping an eye on.
Yeah, it looks fascinating, and it's a completely different way of using, from what I can see already, the hard disk which we already have.
Well, I'll believe it when I've got one in my machine.
Yeah, that's always the way with this stuff, isn't it, sadly? Very quick link I'm going to put in is to a story about desktop containers. The GNOME guys have been writing quite a lot about containers recently, and if you want to know kind of what their thoughts are, although you might have picked up from a few of my comments in previous shows, this link might help you understand that.
And a couple of plugins for XFCE that make it not XFCE anymore and more like horrible things like Unity and GNOME Shell.
This is bizarre, isn't it? I mean, it kind of shows what the open source world's all about, really, that people can get off their backsides and just do what they want. But also, doing what they want isn't necessarily always a good idea. I mean, the two things you're talking about, there's an application that puts maximized window buttons and the title on the actual top toolbar in XFCE, so it's a lot more like Unity, for instance. And the second one we're going to link to is like it's a GNOME Shell-like dashboard for XFCE. It does actually look pretty damned ugly if you install it, because I tried both of these. I just can't see why anyone would want that functionality. If you're using XFCE, it's because it's nice and simple. And if you want something that isn't, then GNOME's there anyway.
Yeah, it reminds me, this second one, the XF dashboard, which makes it look like the GNOME dashboard, reminds me of the Expo mode in Cinnamon. But I use Cinnamon because it has Expo, not trying to make XFCE look like it. And I can't imagine anyone would want to put the title bar and the close menu, etc., in the top toolbar. It just seems like the thing that people who use Unity go on about the most of the first thing they remove from Unity. So to actually implement it in XFCE seems like a massive step backwards. So I can't understand these.
Well, first they came for my Ubuntu, and I didn't speak out because I didn't use Ubuntu. And then they came for my GNOME. I didn't speak out. And now they come for my XFCE and there's no one left to speak out for me. No, it's quite clear that people can do whatever they want, and fair play to them. If you want to hack things, that is the brilliant thing about open source. But please, please, XFCE people, don't put it in. And as Ubuntu people, I don't want to see that by default.
And on that very concerned note, should we move on to first impressions?
Yeah, let's do that.
On the last show, DistroWatch's random distribution button gave Joe StartOS. Now, I can remember there was a bit of a brouhaha when version 3 of StartOS was released, as their desktop bore an uncanny resemblance to Windows XP, and they carried on down the road with version 4 looking like Vista. So I guess my first question for you, Joe, is whether version 5, have they aped the appearance of Windows 7, or have they finally moved on and found a look and feel all of their own?
Neither. They've basically stolen Linux Mint. It's pretty much Cinnamon.
Is that so bad?
No, it's good, actually. I mean, my genuine first impression of this was going to the website, and StartOS is in English, and then the StartOS is in English, and StartOS is in English. Everything else is some sort of Chinese characters. I'm not sure if it's simplified or whatever, but suffice to say, I cannot read it. Thankfully, there's a big green button with a down-facing arrow on it, which presumably says download. Mm-hmm. And you click that and it starts downloading. So that's a good start. And it's interesting that on the front page of StartOS, there's a picture of an iMac running it. I don't know what it is with these Eastern distros, but they just imagine that people are going to run them on Macs.
Yeah, it takes us back to last time a little bit when we were looking at Deepin.
Yeah, quite similar in that way. It's a very slow mirror as well, unfortunately. I was only getting, well, it was fluctuating quite wildly, but about sort of 250 kilobytes a second, which for a 973 megabyte ISO was pretty painful. So I just had to start it going and go and do something else. You know, I'm used to getting on a decent torrent up to 18 megabytes a second. So not wanting to rub it in or anything, but that was quite unusual.
And was there no option for torrents on the site?
Well, that's the problem. They probably were, but it's all in Chinese, and I use Firefox, so it didn't translate it. Thinking about it, I probably could have used Chromium or Chrome and translated it, but I didn't.
Well, anyway, once you got hold of the ISO, how do things go from there?
Well, pretty well, really. Unit booting works, and it boots into this familiar basically Mint style desktop, but obviously it's all in Chinese. But thankfully there's a sort of icon that looks like a hard disk, and you can double click on that and it brings up the installer. And once you work out which drop down menu changes it to US English, then it's pretty much plain sailing from there. It's got a huge list of keyboard layouts, and they're like in a completely random order, and it didn't include GB or UK or England or anything like that, but it did have Ireland, so, you know, close enough. And then the rest of the installer is just so simple. It's all one screen. You just put in your username and password, and your partition setup is on the same screen, and then just press go. And it was pretty fast, I must say. It quicker than Ubuntu or Mint. Definitely, or Zubuntu even. And after that, boots back into the same desktop, only in English. It actually remembered it, which was good. And no sign of updates once I'd connected to my network. But I opened up the software center, and it looks pretty Windowsy, quite similar to Deepin again. It is very similar in a lot of ways to Deepin, actually. And it prompted me to update it in very much like Mint does, where you kind of update the updater first. And then it offered me about 10 updates, which it did perfectly. So, I mean, it's obviously a fairly new version, the one that I got. As I say, I didn't read any of the documentation because it was all in Chinese and I didn't use Chrome to translate it. And it comes with quite a full set of applications, actually. Pretty much everything you would want, and Flash and Codex are installed out of the box, and it's got Chromium rather than Firefox. But that software center I used obviously for updates, but also to install stuff, and it was fairly simple, worked pretty well, didn't have that horrible bloat of certain other software centers. Passed the VLC test, and I was wondering, what exactly is it running? Because it looks very cinnamony. And I used INXI, and it said it was GNOME 2.32.1, which is basically one of the last versions of GNOME 2. So they've obviously kept that going, which is interesting, rather than using Mate. But one thing that was really terrible was Nautilus. You double-clicked it, or clicked it to open it, and it took about 5-6 seconds to open up. I just didn't think it was working at first. I don't really understand why that is. I'd never had a problem like that, obviously, with Mate or with other GNOME 2-based distros. So,
have you experienced it on XFCE, though, with Thunar in the past?
No, I haven't. You haven't, really?
Okay, I have. And that was on somebody's Ubuntu machine, and it was an issue while it was looking for network shares. And if you disabled it searching for network things, then it got on quite happily very quickly. So it could well be that.
Yeah, it could well be that, yeah. So, I mean, I'd heard that it was supposedly billed as this Windows replacement, but I mean, to me, it's just not much different from Mint. I definitely wouldn't say it was any worse, and it's definitely no better. It's kind of just, to me, it feels like a kind of Chinese Mint, really.
So is it maybe termed a Windows replacement because Mint and Cinnamon are quite Windows-esque? So from the outside, it would look like a direct Windows replacement just because we know the inner details. We were able to say it looks like Cinnamon.
I suppose, yeah, that's probably a fair assessment that, yeah, it is fairly Windows-like. It's got the start menu in the right place. It's got your panel and your clock and everything and your window buttons. So I suppose in that sense, it is a Windows replacement. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's just because, obviously, we know about it. But, yeah, if you'd never used Linux before and you tried this, obviously, if you were in China, then it probably would be fairly similar.
And so the various aspects of the desktop, do they, obviously Mint and GNOME, etc., or Cinnamon and GNOME, etc., have various icons and widgets, etc., you can install. So how does this work with that? Did you try any of those additions or changing things in the toolbar? Because that would surely be GNOME 2.
I did try a little bit, and it was pretty much GNOME 2-like. But I must admit, I didn't give it much time. I just kind of wanted to give it a true first impression, really, rather than a deep dive.
And is there any reason other people couldn't use this one-page installer? It sounds like a good idea to have everything on one space where you can just see it all and get it all filled in one go. Was there anything missing?
Well, obviously, if you want to do complicated partitioning or multi-user setup, then it's got that missing. But for a Windows replacement, for want of a better word, like Mint or Ubuntu, I think you're right. it could be used, this installer, this one page installer. I mean, I've gone on in the past, and we both have, me and Paddy, talked about how great Ubiquiti is, but I think that there is quite a lot potentially to be learned from the StartOS installer, because it's just so simple.
Okay, thanks for summarizing that distro of StartOS, Joe. What have we got coming up next?
Well, what have I got for you? The random button. Okay. So, the old version of this was an OS originally designed in England in 1987, and it was specifically designed to run on the ARM chipset. And I'm trying not to give it away here. But suffice to say, this is a Raspberry Pi distro, and it says that it's not a version of Linux, nor is it in any way related to Windows, and it has a number of unique features and aspects to its design. I take it you do have a Raspberry Pi to try it on.
I have a couple of Raspberry Pis, yeah, I can get one, okay. Make one spare.
Okay, so what do you think then? Any guesses?
It sounds like RiskOS.
Yes, RiskOS Open. Well done.
Okay, I've avoided that installer, so I'll have to jump in.
Well, I'll look forward to hearing how you get on.
On the last show, I mentioned that I'd been to a Google Glass event. Well, it turns out that the person that I went to it with was Jesse. And we thought it might be a good idea to record our kind of instant reaction when we came out of it. It was recorded on my Nexus 5, so it's not brilliant quality, and it's kind of outside, and there's people talking in the background and stuff, but you get the idea, and it's kind of our first impressions of it anyway. So let's hear it. So I'm here outside the Google Glass event that I've just been to with Jesse. What did you think of it?
I thought it was very interesting. I thought you got a lot of time to interact with the glass, and they showed us, is it four different apps they had?
Yeah.
And each one was very different. So there was the stargazing, so you could see like an augmented reality in front of your eye.
Yeah, kind of like Google, was it Sky Maps?
Yep.
That you
got
on your phone, you hold it up, and yes, you just look up to the stars, and then it gives you an audio description of stuff.
Yeah, so there's a little tiny sort of speaker that goes into the bone in the back of your ear, and that's the way that you hear the audio. And there's also a music recognition one, a bit like Shazam, which was interesting but limited.
Yeah, it kind of shows the lyrics on the screen, and it was all just rubbish music. Maybe if you are looking for a song, if you listen to a song and you want to know what it is, that might be quite useful, but not really for me. But the killer one was the translation, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was definitely one to look out for. So they had a whole load of different screens and posters and things and signs of German or French or Spanish, what have you, and you selected whether you wanted it from Spanish to English or English to Spanish or whatever you needed, and then you looked at it, it then translated it, and on the screen it captured the font, captured the colour, and just translated it back into the language you wanted, which is absolutely fantastic.
You hadn't realised that it had done it at first, did you?
Yeah, that was one. I was waiting for it, and I looked back at the original and realised that, oh, it has. I'm reading in English, you idiot. So yeah, it was really, really good one.
Yeah, it kind of felt like a big sales pitch though, didn't it? Like it was clear that they were there trying to sell it. That they can dress it up how they like with, you know, demos and whatever, but really it was a sales event.
Yeah, and at a grand, I don't know anyone who's going to buy one.
Yeah.
It's out of the price range.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could get, for the kind of other technology you can get for around that £1,000 price mark, you could get a sweet laptop for that. I mean, if it was a couple of hundred quid, I might think about it, but it's just too expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they did have all different styles. So there's the standard headband, which you'll have seen, but they've also got different styles of glasses and shades and other ones you can have. So you can have prescriptions as well. But I felt that the bit that you had to look up to see was a little bit too in the way of my eye. So if I, obviously for the event, we were constantly looking at what the screen showed us and moving around, taking videos, etc. But then if you just looked around the event, you suddenly realized that there was something in your vision, there was something in the way, and that I think detracted, and it shouldn't get in the way.
But that's the problem with it. How can you have it be useful if it's not in the way? You know, if you have it too high up, then you can't see it. So it's always going to be, but they kind of sold it as, well, it's not always on, you kind of just wake it up when you need it, and so that screen isn't going to be there most of the time.
So I can kind of see that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. You don't want to have to be straining your eyes to look at it when you do want to look at it. It needs to be out the way, but in the way. So it's a difficult balance to be had. But I thought it heard your voice very well. We had a little play with scanning through the settings, and obviously you say, okay, glass, and then you've got Google or listen to this or translate that, or whatever the... What do they call apps? They're called apps...
Glassware.
Glassware. So, yeah, so all the different glassware apps that you had, you could command. But you could also scroll through manually. So maybe if you're sat on the tube or wherever it is, you know, in a restaurant, you could actually scroll through rather than having to speak everything out loud, which is basically embarrassing in all situations. So, yeah, you can scroll through and get it. And then obviously it's got Google search and stuff. But we had a look at websites as well.
Yeah, and trying to click links was just a nightmare. It's not for web browsing, is the bottom line.
No. So you could read, you'd scroll through a website and you could read the text, but you certainly wouldn't use it for browsing. Get your phone out for that.
I mean, you might maybe read in headlines or, you know, read it, checking an RSS feed or something, but not actually interacting with a website in any way.
Yeah, or like Google Now post, obviously, those the cards, as they say.
Yeah.
So, for example, you could search Google for a statistic or a score or a specific piece of information, and that card would come back with a photo or the answer, and that's fine as a specified piece of information. But if you're just browsing and casually perusing, it's not going to work.
No, not at all. And a couple of my concerns are battery life, first and foremost. They said 6 to 8 hours, but then he said that if you're recording video constantly, then it's about 45 minutes, which... I mean, he said, oh, it's not for that. But I mean, that's one of the main things that I would use it for, I think. If I'm at an event that I want a video, I'd just be, rather than having to hold a phone up all the time, just put these glasses on, then whatever I'm looking at, it's video in. So they really, I think the main problem is that the battery has got to be really light. And until the battery technology improves, it's going to be a problem. You're going to have to charge it quite a lot.
Yeah, everything's on the one side, isn't it? So the battery's behind the ear.
Yeah.
And it, I didn't notice it feeling particularly heavy. We didn't have it on for, you know, hours and hours at a time.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel too heavy. But you're right, you need a battery that... I mean, they were sort of saying, oh, I can just about get through the day. That was a sort of general impression, was 8 hours. Well, my day's not 8 hours. My day's like 12, 14 hours.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm happy that my phone can do it, but they all, you know, the caveat of... It's how much you use it, it's the use case, etc. It's fair enough, but you do want it to be there when you need it, not, oh, it's run out at the end, you know, by the time I've gone home.
Yeah. And while we were looking at the translation thing, the one that I was using basically just stopped working, which was quite surprising. I was tapping it and trying to make it work, and the camera function just stopped working, so it wouldn't... I selected the language to translate and then looked at... the wall of, they had various posters in different foreign languages, and it just, the camera wouldn't work, and I tried turning it off and on again, and it just was buggy. But I mean, it isn't a final release yet, is it? I mean, it's the £1,000 is for basically a development release, a beta, just to be an early adopter.
Yeah, one of the guys we were talking to, they only had specific apps on each of the glasses, so that when you're at a station you had that app that you needed. And one of the guys we were talking to was explaining about some other apps, and he let me try his one, which had a whole range of apps. And I asked him about one which was Learn This Song, and he looked at me blankly because he hadn't ever heard of it before, put it back on himself, and realized it had been updated this morning, and they'd added one on there that he'd never even heard of. So it's that fast an evolution that the people who even have it and are developers are being caught out by it. So yeah, there's you know, there's a long way to go. But it was good to get a hands-on, and I thought the screen was crisp enough for what it needed to be, but it wasn't super high definition.
Yeah, you can tell it's really low resolution screen. It kind of feels like old school 640, 480 or whatever. It's really, you can't fit that much on it, but it's not really for that, I suppose. To me, it seemed a bit dull, the screen. It could have been brighter. But then I suppose that would distract you from whatever you're looking at. So
partly distracting, partly battery life.
Battery life, yeah. But I don't see why they don't put another battery the other side, on the other side of the behind your left ear.
That occurred to me. The only thing there was that all the different styles they had, whether it be headbands, shades, round ones, you know, spectacle type things, there's a single screw that came off, they explained, didn't they? So a single screw comes off, the whole... glasses section and left hand ear piece, if you will, comes off, and you replace it wholesale. So the right hand side with the touchpad and the battery and the acoustic and the microphone and the screen and everything stays true, whichever colour you've chosen, and then you change the glasses on the left-hand side. So I suppose it just adds to the cost of the interchangeability by having another battery.
Yeah. But all in all, it's been a very interesting morning, hasn't it? And as you say, to actually get hands-on, because as I said before, with a phone or a tablet, you can watch a YouTube video and get an idea of it. And you managed to just about take some photos of the screen, kind of holding it up in a certain way. But you can only describe it to people. You can't actually see it until you actually wear the glasses. So I would say it's well worth coming to an event like this just to check it out, even if, like me, you've got no intention of buying it.
Yeah, and I can't imagine these were released, what, a year ago when people were sort of getting all excited about them?
Yeah.
And they must have come on so much in that year to what we've seen today that they must have seemed very limited and very useless back in the day. You'd have to have a very good foresight to think about it, because the apps that we were using have only been developed since then. Apps, whatever they want to call them. Like I say, changes to be made, but interesting to get your hands on.
Yeah, look forward to trying it again.
So it sounds like you had a really interesting time there, but there were a couple of things you picked up on which is probably worth knocking about. I mean, battery life for one. You commented that you'd only get 45 minutes of recording time.
Yeah, absolutely woeful, that, isn't it? I mean, as I've said, I think on Mintcast, that's one of the primary reasons I would want it, to record things like talks at Odcamp or whatever.
And it gave you no indication they're looking to improve battery life at all?
Not really. It seems to me that they didn't really know that much about it. I mean, a guy that we were talking to about it didn't even know what apps were on it and was surprised every day when he gets updates and new apps and stuff. And also, it didn't know what resolution the screen was. I had assumed that it would be somewhere in the region of 640 by 480, and I think it's actually slightly less than that. So they weren't that clued up on it. They were more clued up on what it can do right now rather than what it's actually going to be and whether there's going to be another generation of hardware.
Yeah, they certainly seem to be more user-focused than technical-focused. Any of the questions we had, which went into any of the detail about, as you're saying, resolution or what the processor, etc. was, it was very much met with a blank wall. But if you ask them how to scroll through a menu and nod your head up, etc., they're all over it.
So it sounds very much like a sales meeting for a technology preview of a device. I mean, what do you think the actual purpose of these meetings all around the country are?
I think it's probably to get people like us hands-on and to have a real look. There was a questionnaire at the very end, which we filled in on the Chromebook Pixel, I should point out.
Yeah, the beautiful Chromebook Pixel.
It was very nice. And so you filled that out, and there was a few questions, and one of which being, would you consider yourself at the forefront of technology? And the various answers of, at the very cutting edge, I would buy this device now, all the way down to, no, unless it's 5 years old. And I realised I put myself initially at the first one, but I wouldn't buy that device now. I wouldn't buy a device that's that, not just the glass, but any device which is that raw and still in such development. I've realized I'm not at that cutting edge. I'm a step back.
That's why you fit in with us. But like a smartwatch, for example, you wouldn't have one of them.
I could see why people like smartwatches, but certainly not at the moment, no.
Okay, yeah. I can't at all. So do you want to explain that one to me, Jesse?
Because I think it depends on how you use your phone. If you're using your phone for calls and putting data into the phone, text, for example, looking at the internet, then glass and watches won't help. But if you're using your phone to look at the tweets which are coming in, to look at your Google Plus posts which are coming in, to look at your reminders which are coming in, your calendar, and these are all feeding in just small pieces of information which you absorb rather than put out, that's where the glass or the watch comes into play, because that small piece of information can go onto a screen that size and you just need to glance and then you carry on without doing the whole phone rigmarole.
Yeah, and I think that how I would use a smartwatch, when I travel on the tube, I put my music on random all, basically. That's if I haven't got a podcast to listen to. And I find myself just skipping constantly through my hundreds and hundreds of songs. And I kind of look to see what the song is and then click next. And if I had my phone just in my pocket and then I could just flick through on my watch, I think that would be quite convenient. But for such a small use case, there's no way I could justify spending a couple of hundred quid plus on one. I mean, as I said regarding the glass, I think that's worth maybe a couple of hundred quid, and I might think about spending that much. And obviously, if someone gave me one, then I'd be all over it and I would love to use them. But I don't think it's me necessarily being tight. I think it's just me not justifying that kind of expense for something that is essentially a toy. I mean, tablets are essentially a toy. You could argue that a smartphone is not a toy, and I use it for work and stuff as well as for pleasure. And so to me, it is an essential tool. Whereas tablets and then the next generation of toys being wearables, that's all just toys, isn't it? Certainly I find it hard to justify buying them. And I really love my Nexus 7, but it is, I don't need it.
But I think my advice would be therefore maybe get some better music tastes, but also the difference between the glass and the watch is that the watch you can show your friends at the pub, flash it out, and then you don't see it until you want to look at it. But I would be very self-conscious if I was to wear the glass as it is now, because it's such an odd thing. You'd have looks and questions every single time you went out in public with it. So I think the watch would win over the glass just for the awkwardness appeal or disappeal.
Yeah, I think that you're definitely right there. A watch, obviously, as you say, is just tucked under your sleeve, or even if you're wearing a t-shirt, it just looks like a watch, quite a big bulky watch, but some fashion watches are big anyway. So yeah, people aren't necessarily going to know it's a smartwatch, but there's no getting away from the fact that this thing is some sort of computer that you've got on your face. I mean, that's one thing that I was really interested to see is how big is it? And obviously you've seen photos of it and stuff, but to actually have a hands-on and put them on and look in the mirror, you realize that it is very conspicuous.
They were surprisingly lightweight though, weren't they?
Yeah, which is why they really could get away with a second battery, I think, if they redesigned it. I mean, obviously it needs to clip off and stuff, but I just don't understand why they don't redesign it to have a second battery on it. It's not that heavy now, and I don't think it would necessarily be too heavy. And to double the battery life, essentially, or maybe even more, because obviously you've got all the innards of it, all the processor and RAM and all that stuff. You could maybe have three times the battery life if you put a big battery on the other side. Mm-hmm. And I really think they ought to do that.
Yeah, maybe this is one of the things they'll get from feedback, but it is still a prototype, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and it's £1,000 for a prototype. I think they're having a laugh, really.
Well, I think they probably are, to be honest, because I've seen a variety of teardown estimate costs and actual materials and build costs between $150 and $200. So you're looking at almost 10 times as much retail.
Yeah, and it's no Nexus, is it, in terms of the subsidy? But all in all, it was definitely worth going to, and I'm really glad that I got a hands-on and a face-on, as it were. And I think that maybe one day something like that will be popular, but I think of the wearables, watches definitely stand the most chance of becoming ubiquitous like smartphones and tablets.
I agree. Watches will become the next must-have toy. Yep.
I'm not entirely convinced. I mean, we've spent several years now glancing at smartphones and people have been discarding watches in favour of just looking at the smartphones to get the time once in a while. So I'm not sure whether they're ready to go back again.
Well, time will tell. I think it's not going to be overnight, but I didn't think that tablets were going to take off and they did. So I daren't say that smartwatches won't, just in case.
Okay, well, on that note, shall we move on to the feedback?
Yeah, let's do that. First of all, then, thanks a lot to Maxim Kovgan and Nicholas Betson for your PayPal donations. And thanks to the three anonymous people who flattered us. And a special thanks to our new monthly supporters, Jeroen Van Ryn, Brendan McWade, and Isaac Carter. It's very much appreciated, guys.
Yes, thanks very much to all of you guys. And to anybody else out there who wants to help us out but can't afford to do so financially, just spread the word. If you like what you hear, tell someone about it. Moving on to our first piece of proper feedback then, Son of Ned wrote and said, appreciated the update on SystemD as I'd not paid attention for a while. I ran across a pharaonic summary of Leonard Pottering's May 2014 keynote talk, A Perspective for SystemD, What Has Been Achieved, What Lies Ahead. And I'll put the links to the slides to this in the show notes. Unfortunately, there's no video available. And Son of Ned continued, it really just struck me how breathtakingly enormous the expansion in scope and ambition the SystemD project has become. I've never been inclined personally to use the label GNU/Linux when referencing distros, but if Leonard's vision comes to fruition, I could see myself starting to say SystemD/Linux when referring to them. Assuming that systemd doesn't devolve into a disaster in terms of reliability or backward compatibility, it seems unclear to me at this point whether any Linux distro other than a systemd/Linux will be viable once all the dust settles. Like it or not, the next few years look very interesting for Linux distros. And I'll also put a link in the show notes to some commentary that Rob Landley, who's another regular commentator here, wrote on his blog about this, and also a Pharonic story about some changes to UDEV, which, as most of you will know, has been getting increasingly hard to compile separately from systemd. And the story is a typical one that shows Lennart's appreciation for the rest of the wider Linux community. And having just mentioned Rob Landley's blog, the man himself followed up on our comments on show 18 about Dell pushing out what should have been a Steam machine with Windows installed instead. So thanks to Rob for his insights into Dell's and HP's internal politics.
And Rob also asked about comment preview facilities on our website, but that's not going to happen, is it?
Well, I'm not sure. I've had a look at it, and for anyone who hasn't noticed, we're running WordPress. And there are a variety of preview plugins out there, but I'm not particularly impressed with any of them, to be honest. I mean, I'm sure I could probably write something using jQuery, but I haven't got the time at the moment. So if anyone's got any good suggestions for a comment preview system for WordPress that is pretty light and doesn't tend to mess with things too much, drop us a line and I'll see if we can use it.
So Campbell Barton and Rob Langley both left comments on our website suggesting why they think the Go programming language has a bit of a battle ahead of it in gaining much market share. Whilst Campbell does hanker for a slightly safer language that retains the power and expressiveness of C, part of one of Rob's comments sums up their general feeling on the issue, where he wrote, "The problem Go has is that scripting language is already an excellent tool for most of the tasks that C isn't a good fit for. Scripting languages, Perl, Python, Ruby, Lua, PHP and so on, are dynamic everything, not just garbage collection, dynamic typing and exceptions for error handling, but they're even interpreted avoiding the need for makefiles and source versus binary distribution and portability issues. Of course, interpreted here usually involves a dynamic bytecode compilation pass, but that's an implementation detail and that doesn't matter because the abstraction is opaque. It just works and you don't have to care how. Just like combining garbage collection and dynamic typing lets you have dictionaries as a base type, and most users don't care whether they're implemented with hash tables or trees or something else entirely because it just works. The abstractions in languages like C++ leak implementation details, so you have to know how it was implemented in order to use it reliably, let alone debug it. Adding more abstractions to that sort of thing just makes the problem worse. The beauty of C is it has a minimum of abstraction standing between the programmer and what the machine is actually doing, just enough that porting from x86 to ARM isn't a complete rewrite like it would be in an assembly language. The tools it gives you are knives and hammers. Easy to screw up with, but without the "it just went off, I didn't know it was loaded" kind of issues of more automated tools with hidden state.
Both Mark and Rob McKenzie picked up on my comments about Google, as did Nigel Verity, who said, "I'm not sure I can agree with Joe's assertion that Google's market dominance is something to be applauded, given that they have achieved it through their own ingenuity and hard work." He's absolutely right that if people didn't like their products, they wouldn't have grown to be so big. But people and organizations have a tendency to get drunk with power. There are very few cases of individuals standing down from positions of power or organizations disbanding once their original goals have been achieved. There is a danger of Google, Facebook, and Amazon becoming so big and geographically diverse that they can operate beyond the effective control of governments. Yeah, but as I said, fair play to them. You know, they worked hard for it. Let them completely dominate the world.
Yeah, I'll come back to that in just a second, shall we? Dave Allen also picked up on your comments on Google, and he said, "Joe said in podcast 18, and I quote, 'I've got nothing to hide. I know it's a terrible, terrible thing to say, but it's true,' in relation to leaving Google and setting up your own services to host and manage your stuff. I'm sure you're fully aware of this, but I wanted to mention it anyway because it means so much to me. I get this a lot from my non-tech friends or people who don't think about this stuff. No fault of theirs, they're doing other things. Having something to hide doesn't necessarily mean that you're up to no good. Everyone, every day, does something that you wouldn't like to broadcast to the wide world. Everyone sits on the toilet, everyone has events in their daily lives, which are completely legal and normal, but are extremely private to them as individuals. I've got no problem with people using Google et al. I'm heavily invested into Google. I just hate it when people use the I've nothing to hide argument. It shows a failure of understanding of the difference between privacy and security.
Well, I did somewhat say that to troll people, I must admit, because obviously I understand the arguments, and not having anything to hide is not really a good argument for letting people walk all over your privacy.
It goes back a little bit to the comments we received last time as well, doesn't it, about normalization of behavior and you modifying your own behavior to fit in with what you feel is acceptable to the state if we know we're being spied upon all the time. And although we've talked about this on the show a couple of occasions now, I'll put a link in to a TechDirt article, which also goes down the same path, but probably explains things a little bit more eloquently than we did. What I found interesting in this article, though, was a line in the last paragraph, and they've been talking about normalization and not upsetting the apple cart and how that's changing people's behaviors. And it says, the way we keep a strong democracy is by having people who are able and willing to challenge the status quo and those in power. Now, that sounds all well and good in theory, but I would actually challenge the concept that we do live in a strong democracy in the first place, either here or in the States. I mean, we talked about how the new surveillance laws were ramrodded through Parliament in one day, and similar activities have gone on over the water. So, do we really live in a strong democracy, or are we actually fooling ourselves here with all of this?
I don't think so. I think the democracy comes from the groundswell. And as we were talking about the Microsoft tablets not being sold and Microsoft having to buck the trend and reduce their cost, that's come from people going with their wallets and not buying them, but buying something else. They've been forced to move. And I think that in a similar way, but on a political side, if people make privacy and security known to the governments that they're issues they worry about or are interested in, then these items won't get pushed through so quickly. At the moment, there is simply the government saying it's good for you and some people waving their flags and arms in the air trying to say, don't do this, don't do this. But I think if the general populace said, hang on a minute, I have nothing to hide, but I have all of these things that I'm concerned about because my data isn't just yours, it's mine. I think it needs the general populace to have an understanding of what's going on and have their opinions turned. And I do see the tech industry as the sort of spearhead of that. Of course they are, because they see it every day. They use all this tech much more than everyone else does. And therefore, their stuff is online. Their stuff is on other people's servers. And so I feel in a couple of years, there will be something that pushes through. And not just Edward Snowden, not just whatever other leaks come on, but there'll be something that pushes through that the general public suddenly realize that your own privacy is much bigger than they've realized up until now. And so I think that to go back to Dave Allen's point, his friends who are not techie or don't think much about this stuff will be thinking about this. And at that point, security and privacy will be at the forefront of people's minds, and therefore governments won't be able to do the things they're currently doing. That's how I see the next couple of years.
Right, it's nice to have a positive voice on the show. Counteract my cynicism.
You know, I didn't say what it was that thing would be, but I just see a thing.
Okay.
Martin Wimpress also wrote in and said, just following up on your query about how Mate is intended to support GTK 3, we're adding support for GTK 3, but we'll continue to support GTK 2. It is a build time configuration option as to which toolkit you build against. It will therefore be a matter for your distro package maintainer to decide if they only support one of the available toolkits or both. On Arch Linux, I'll be supporting both. It is typical of the Mate team. For example, we support both ConsoleKit and systemd logind. We are not forcing anyone down a particular path. Mate is inclusive.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that clarification, Martin. And the alpha was looking good, so we very much look forward to the release candidate and ultimately the release of Ubuntu Mate Remix. Also, thanks to Jeroen van Rijn for some suggestions of topics that we might want to look at in future shows, and to Christian for pointing us towards a patch from Ted Cho, which shows that the kernel team are not adverse to taking lessons in best practice from the OpenBSD guys.
Yeah, that was good to see. And Will wrote in on a different topic and said, you guys have mentioned several times that stock XFCE requires a lot of tweaking to be in a state you find acceptable. Are there any links you can point to, or can you give me an overview of what you do to tweak it? I use Debian and RHEL. I've installed XFCE on them, but I'm not sure how to modify it. I guess I could make a Zubuntu or Mint XFCE edition live USB and try to compare that to my installations.
I've often thought about writing a blog post about how I customize XFCE. Because it's pretty far from the default XFCE, it's quite far from Zubuntu, but it's quite close to the Linux Mint 17 XFCE edition version. So, I mean, really, it's about your personal choice, but maybe writing a detailed blog post with screenshots about how I configure it to how I want it would be enlightening as to how to configure it how you want to do it. Even if it's fairly different from mine, at least it'll show you the ways to do the things that I like to do. So I'll add it to my massive to-do list.
I don't know, the other way of looking at this is maybe he's just wondering where you would go from the standpoint. So there's theming, there are different window decorations you can have, there are different fonts, there's different backgrounds, etc. And I think maybe not just for XFCE, but for all of them, it'd be sensible to break down what the different options of changing the themes are. It's not just the desktop background, it is, as I say, the fonts and the colours, etc., etc. So perhaps something to look at on a future show.
Maybe, but I mean, to me, the theming is less important than the layout of it. For me, it's more about getting the panels where I want them and getting the things that I want on those panels in the right places.
Yeah, toolbars and docks and stuff do make quite a big difference to the general way that you use the distro, so that is quite an important first point of call for a lot of people.
Oh, well, I look forward to seeing what you write then, Joe.
And well, one day.
And Will also asked if any of us had experienced any issues when using an external monitor against a laptop that's actually running XFCE. Now, since I don't have a laptop running XFCE, I can't comment, but you do. Have you tried on an external monitor and have you had problems?
I briefly tried to watch something. I can't remember what it was. It was briefly after 1404 came out, and I tried to hook it up. It was some TV show that I wanted to watch or some film or something, and it just wouldn't work. So I booted into a live LXDE, I think Lubuntu, and that worked perfectly. So yes, I have experienced issues with external monitors, but I have not fixed them. I've just gone for a kind of sledgehammer approach of trying something completely different.
I have to admit, I've never tried to put external monitors onto any of my laptops, so I also can't really be much help, I'm afraid. But moving on to Richard Marsh and his kind words about the show and for flagging up that we can be difficult to find in some podcatchers. Earlier, Muldrich pointed out that he couldn't find us on iTunes either.
So now we've finally relented, haven't we, Paddy? And we're on iTunes.
Yeah, well, we should have been earlier, to be honest. I mean, when we started the show, I used an external service, external to Apple, to submit us to iTunes. Or I thought I had anyway, but it obviously didn't work. But until Muldwich came along and told me that he couldn't find us there, I was in blissful ignorance about this fact. So I created myself an Apple iTunes account, and
does that mean you're using a proprietary operating system, Paddy?
It means I had to boot into my Vista and install iTunes to actually get this done. It's quite a straightforward process to submit us, and we're now officially on iTunes, and you can, if you search for Linux Luddites, you will find us there. Very few of you actually listen to us on Apple devices. I mean, we do have download stats, but I know some of you do. But I think more importantly is that a lot of other podcast services seem to suck their listings from iTunes. So hopefully that'll ripple out a little bit to the podcatchers, such as Richard's talking about, and will be more easily discoverable.
Yeah, hopefully. The more the merrier, eh?
Anyway, moving on. Stephen Rosenberg wrote to us and said, "Great show, Joe and Paddy. The interviews have been great, including these episodes with Randall Schwartz. Now that you've had Randall on, maybe you two could talk about your opinions on scripting languages. The Joe and Paddy take on Perl versus Python versus Ruby, and maybe versus server-side JavaScript too. Any of those, JavaScript accepted, should appeal to the Luddite within. Perl more so that because it's the oldest. Most of my scripting these days is in Bash because it's easiest for me. I've been working on Perl, but I'm considering switching to either Python or Ruby. What do you think?"
I think it would be a pretty one-sided conversation.
I don't know if it would be a great conversation from my end either, to be honest, because I've not spent a lot of time coding in any of those languages, and I hate to sort of pontificate on things which I don't have at least a modicum of grasp of. So I think it's a reasonable idea, for a feature at some stage along the line, but possibly with different participants. If we could rope a few folks in to have a chat in a group interview, that'd be, I think, probably a good thing to do.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to hear that kind of talk, I think, that kind of discussion.
Well, let's have a think about it and see what we can put together. And Stephen also gave us some links related to development builds of the next Fedora version. So check out his comments below the line in the show notes for last time for more information if this is something you're also interested in.
And Stephen also linked to a blog post of his that detailed how to sort out the XFCE screen blanking issue. Now, I must admit, I've been massively busy the last couple of weeks and just haven't had a chance to check it out yet. But again, it's on my massive to-do list.
So finally, Rob Landley joined Son of Ned in pointing out that Patreon seems to be an increasingly popular means of crowdfunding reoccurring support for artistic endeavours, including podcasts. Now, I know Patreon is something that the Linux Action Show guys are using, so maybe that's something that we should be looking at.
What's the Linux? Never heard of that, I'm afraid. Yeah, maybe we could look at it, but now that we've got these recurring PayPal donations, I know that a lot of people hate PayPal, but some people seem to be interested in that. So have you looked into Patreon, Paddy?
Yeah, I mean, the fee structure is basically very similar to PayPal, so it wouldn't actually benefit either ourselves or the listeners if we went down that route financially. I mean, I guess where it could possibly be of interest is if people have a Patreon account already and are happy using that as a service as opposed to PayPal, as you suggest. So really, a little bit more feedback's required. If people want us to get a Patreon account, we'd be very happy to do so. We'd be happy no matter how you help us out. And as I mentioned at the top of the feedback, whilst we do welcome donations, it all helps us keep the show on the road. Really, the thing we would love you to do is, if you enjoy the show, tell somebody about it, spread the word, and let's get more listeners.
Yeah, as I always say, the more the merrier.
A couple of shows back, Gregor asked us for recommendations for distros for an XP refugee, and Paddy mentioned a couple of lightweight window managers. So we thought we'd have a look at a few of them in a bit more detail. And so we picked ISWM, JWM, which is Joe's Windows Manager, great name, obviously going to be great, and EDE, which is the Equinox desktop environment. So ISWM then, what do you think, guys?
Well, I'm slightly familiar with Fluxbox, and I have to say that installing ISWM did give me that flashback to the good old Fluxbox days. So it's a fairly simple-looking desktop, which I would say was a lot more familiar than the other two we looked at. So it was a bit more Windows 95-esque, if that's a good thing or not.
It's a brilliant thing.
In the documentation, it admits that it tries to imitate OS 2, OS 3, or Windows 95. So a little bit of issue with the default terminal. I found my writing wasn't coming up. So I was LSing and just making sure things worked, and none of the letters were coming up. So it was an odd thing. I've installed it on top of Linux Mint 17. And so I quit out, and there's a second ISWM option to log into once you've got to the login screen. So upon a second boot, came back in and everything was absolutely fine. And I have to say, I like the default menu. It had a good range of options, a range of pre-installed things that you could load straight away. And it all seemed to be fairly accessible and super fast. So I was very pleased with it.
Yeah, I installed it in Zubuntu, and it's just really straightforward. You just apt-get install ISWM and then log out, log back in. And I liked it in terms of the basic but functional layout. I mean, it is essentially the traditional Windows layout, isn't it? With one bottom panel, with the menu, quick launch, workspaces. Well, the workspaces obviously might throw a Windows user. I know I've never got into it. But you got your window buttons. And all of them, I don't, what is it with lightweight desktops having the CPU monitor? I suppose it's because you're going to be running it on really old hardware, and so it kind of matters how well your CPU is doing. Certainly on the Raspberry Pi with LXDE, they have one. But if you're just running it on a fairly reasonable but fairly old box, then you don't really need that.
No, whereas the Raspberry Pi one is basically digital. It's either fully loaded or not.
Pretty much.
This one really gets that much use, that load.
Something I'm interested in, because both of you guys installed it from repos, whereas I actually compiled it, is people have a habit of theming these lightweight desktop managers in their own way. So I guess we're none of us are talking about the same looking product at the end of the day.
Well, did yours look really ugly?
Was it grey?
Yeah, it is out of the box, to be fair. I think JWM, which we'll talk about in a minute, my experience will have been slightly different from you two. But yeah, ISWM does look pretty ugly out of the box. The other thing that I find very annoying initially was having to click to get the menus to open. I don't know if that had been configured on yours differently, but it is a very easy configuration change in the preferences file.
Yeah, I don't know how to feel about that. I kind of feel it's quite nice in that you click the menu and then you go up to, say, internet, and then you have to click that to expand it. And it's not what I'm used to, and it did throw me at first, but then I thought, actually, it's quite a good way of doing it because sometimes you accidentally expand things and they get in the way. So I am a little bit torn because it's not what I'm used to, but I think I like it.
As I said, it's very easily configurable anyway, and theming is also very easy to do. There's plenty of themes available at BoxLook. Did you guys try any of those?
I tried out some of the default themes in the list, and they were all just really ugly. So I didn't actually go and get any external ones. I did see some screenshots of some fairly nice-looking themes, but it's not about looking nice. It's like when I'm forced to use Windows for my music stuff. I have that set to classic look, and I'm not interested in eye candy because I suppose I'm not a visual person, so that's probably why I didn't go out looking for themes. And as long as it's functional, I don't really care. And if it is a bit barren and grey, then so be it, as long as it's fast, which obviously, I mean, all of these are. That sort of doesn't really need to be said, but I'm going to say it anyway. They are lightning fast, even on fairly old hardware.
Yeah, I was blown away by how quickly everything went, but then I suppose if you've got rid of all the eye candy, then there is just raw power. But also, if you're coming from Windows XP, no one on Windows does a lot of theming anyway. Windows always looks the same, no matter whose computer you look at it on. So would someone coming from a Windows background be thinking, oh, I'll start to change these colours or the way the mouse click is or this and the other? Would they not just think it's how it is?
I guess that depends who sets it up for them, doesn't it? Because I suspect that a Windows XP refugee, if someone just gave them this or they installed it themselves, they would be stuck straight away because you're having to edit configuration files to get menu entries to appear and to do anything else that you actually fancy. Now, it's not difficult. It's actually very straightforward, and it's reasonably well documented on the web. I mean, their man pages are pretty shocking for ISWM. But anything that requires manual editing of config files probably isn't great for a newbie.
Yeah, agreed. Auto population of start menus or menus is a nice, certainly a nice, if not essential, to have for someone who's just come over.
Now, this is strange, because I was expecting that. I'd read that it didn't do that by default, but I installed a couple of applications to test it. They didn't show up. And then I moved on to JWM, and then came back to have another look at ISWM, and then suddenly the menu, where it had been really sparse and only had a few applications and didn't have most of the stock stuff that comes with Ubuntu, suddenly it was populated by everything, and including the stuff that I'd installed fresh. So presumably JWM had written to that config file that was necessary.
It's because you're running a Debian distro and they've got a menu system there that does auto-generate config files for all these different window managers. This is why I sort of flagged up front that we probably had different experiences running on different desktops and with different configurations, because your experience really will vary depending on what distro you install this on.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, I did find the configuration files on ISWM easier to read than on JWM. JWM's got XML, whereas ISWM is a lot more, I would say, was more user-friendly.
I think it's definitely more traditional Unix, isn't it, where it's all separate configuration files for separate things, and you've got a different file for startup scripts and shutdown scripts and your preferences and what have you, and also separate programs for doing things like setting the background and various other tasks. So it feels very much more traditional in that it's one task per job. Can be, I don't know, I think it swings and roundabouts how easy that is for a user. I mean, I actually found the configuration of JWM, even though it's XML, which is probably one of the worst things ever thrown out by the computer industry, to actually be quite straightforward because it is all in one place. And when you're looking at things like menus, which probably are multi-layered, then something like XML is a good way to describe them. So I don't know, swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, I did like the separate config files on IceWM as compared to JWM. But moving on to JWM and the menus, the menu I had at default was incredibly short, with only terminal, lock, restart and exit, with lock seeming to do nothing, terminal obviously being essential, restart for restarting the window manager itself, and then exit for logging out. But it meant that when I came to look at the config file, there weren't many submenus or examples of titles or icons, etc., for me to use to have a general idea as to how to lay it out. Whereas with IceWM, where it had a more full and submenued initial menu, even if I wanted to change it entirely, I at least had a good starting block to go from. Whereas JWM, not only was it fairly sparse, but I started to wonder what I was supposed to do when I started it up. There's a bit of a change to what I knew.
Well, it's interesting that you say that it was really sparse. I found that, but then I installed a couple of things, just small applications, just to test it. And obviously the menu didn't populate, but restarting the window manager did add those applications to the menu. Is that a Debian thing, Paddy?
Well, the menu generation is, but the refreshing to actually reload it and force the things to appear is part of IceWM and JWM.
Well, that's kind of acceptable, I suppose. It would be nice, obviously, if it auto did it, but it's not that much hassle to just restart it, and it's incredibly quick. I mean, I did this on my test laptop, which I've talked about quite a lot before, which is, I don't know, knocking on 8 years old or something. It's pretty old and clunky. But it just did it instantly. There was no waiting around or anything. You just click restart and it just just a flicker of the screen and then it's restarted.
Yeah, and of course it leaves all your apps running, doesn't it? So it doesn't actually take anything down other than itself, which is great.
Yeah, but one thing, I don't know if this was a particular Ubuntu or Ubuntu configuration, but focus follows mouse. Now, I just cannot get on with that.
I noticed that as well, and I was having a little play with it. I quite enjoyed it. I found it confusing that if your text location is below the window that you're currently using and you focus the mouse on the window which is behind the forward one, it carries on typing even though you can't see that you're typing into that window. It doesn't bring the window into focus. It just carries on typing there, which was slightly confusing when you had a few windows open. But I started to wonder whether I could use it full time. It was a new experience. I quite enjoyed it.
Well, if you use any sort of instant messenger or IRC or anything, then it is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for sharing your passwords and stuff. Focus follows mouse. I just cannot get on with it. I like to click on what I want to focus on, and no, thank you very much. I could never, ever get used to it.
Yeah, agree. There's a very great potential for typing the wrong thing in the wrong window.
I think perhaps I would point out that both IceWM and JWM, as you've mentioned, support sloppy focus. They also support click to focus, and IceWM's got a few other modes as well. And again, it's just a configuration file thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's easy to change, but just by default, it's not good for me.
Had a bit of an issue locating the JWM default configuration files. So looking on, I know it's not quite right, but looking on the Arch Wiki, it said it was in XE. Looking on the JWM website, it said it was in user locale Etsy, but actually it was in Etsy JWM for Mint. And once I'd found it, I copied it over to my home partition as a .jwmrc. And then upon restart, had a lost the toolbar, lost some of the window dressing, lost the restart button. So even once I then changed it all back again so that I could have the original one, having made backups, I couldn't restart it because there was no restart, and all of my guesses on the command line didn't restart it properly either. So I ended up in a bit of a struggle. But there are some nice things about JWM. That was my fault, but some other nice things. I right-click on the windows, you get a maximize X or maximize Y. So you could have it entirely left to right or entirely top to bottom in a similar way that Windows 7 will maximize on either axis, which I thought was a nice addition, actually. It was quite slick.
Sort of makes it a little bit like a tiling window manager, if you want.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Although, I know you're not a massive fan of desktops, Joe, or the number of desktops that distros will put on. I felt 8 was a little bit over the top.
Yeah, I mean, I use one. So when I saw eight, I was like, oh my, what? Why would you need eight? That is really overkill. I mean, obviously easy enough to change again, but just to me, the defaults just aren't what I would use at all.
Did you notice where the images of the windows were in that eight box overview section? As you moved around, the window moved and you could move it onto different desktops and it would then move it along. It was quite slick, even though no one needs eight.
Yeah, I did notice that. And I agree that they do it well, but why eight? I mean, I just don't get it, I'm afraid. But one thing that really annoyed me about both ICE and JWM is that clicking on the clock didn't bring up a calendar. It just brought up an analog clock in a new sort of pop-up window. I mean, what is the point of that? Completely useless.
Like everything else in both of these, that's configurable. And I think that's where these two really win out, is the level of configurability. Very unfriendly for a new user, potentially, which is where we started off this conversation. But the fact you can make things look exactly as you wish. I mean, if you're using JWM, for instance, you can have multiple panels, so you could effectively have a launcher looking like a dock if you're used to having a dock on the screen, as well as your bottom bar that looks like Windows 95 or what have you. Immensely configurable ability to theme windows differently depending on what Windows class they're actually in or which desktop you send them to. Yeah, so I think if you've got a desktop setup you've lived with for a few years perhaps and you just want to replicate it, that's relatively straightforward to do. If you're one of those sort of people that likes changing things all the time, it'll really be a bit of a pain in the backside having to go in and manually do so.
Yeah, I think that where we started this conversation was as an XP replacement. And if you've got a relative that's got a computer, they don't want to buy a new one, and they are willing to try something a little bit different, you could potentially make either one of these almost identical to Windows XP in terms of basic stuff, like if they just use a web browser and maybe the occasional bit of document editing or something, then I think that they would essentially have here a very fast XP replacement. But I think it is something that you would have to spend quite a lot of time setting up and then potentially also have to support in the long term as well.
Yeah, I wondered whether it would be a good replacement desktop for instance, in schools or somewhere where it's centrally managed and everyone gets pushed out the same image.
Yeah, keeping the same configuration file across everyone. And then when you make an update all of them and it's fairly unbreakable.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that could work quite well, I suppose.
But the argument about improving it to make it look like XP I would ask, why don't we use it and make it look just like GNOME 3 or Cinnamon or whatever it is you prefer? But it just takes that long to learn the ways and spend that amount of time getting it to how you want it to be. Or the thing I like about Cinnamon personally, as my desktop of choice, is that I don't really have a vision of what my desktop should look like, but I do like how Cinnamon looks. So this is why when it out of the box it doesn't look very good, you kind of think, oh, this will be quite a lot of effort to get up to the point I want it to be.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point. And if you've got a machine that is capable of Cinnamon or even XFCE, then there are far better options. But if you want to revitalize an ancient machine, then that's when you'd start looking at these, I think.
Yeah, and despite having started this conversation talking about lightweight desktops, we haven't actually spoken about the RAM that these use. Now, it obviously varies depending upon what desktop environment you're plonking them in the first place. But both of them weigh in quite happily less than OpenBox, which is considered to be a very lightweight desktop indeed. Of course, when you think about any sort of software package, one of the questions you ought to be asking yourself is about the support side of things. And there's a bit of a difference in stories here between ICEWM and JWM.
Yeah, I noticed that ICEWM isn't really, well, how can you put it, actively developed anymore?
No, it isn't. I had a look at the developers' mailing list, and there have been two posts this year. Two. And we're now in July. There were about 30 last year, but the last flurry was in September, and it was a whole bunch of folks talking to each other, wondering how they could stop the project from dying because patches had been submitted and weren't getting applied, and there seemed to be no ongoing development planned. And I eventually came across a fork of it that was been updated in the last few days on GitHub. So it looks as if someone's taken matters in their own hand and is actually trying to keep the project going.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I was looking at installing ICEWM Control Panel, which is a GUI for changing some of the fonts and window dressing, etc., etc. And I found that it was only last looked at in 2004. So this must go with what you're saying. There's a list on the website which details all of the graphical engines you can use for theming, and none of them I found were recent or were simply installable. So this must go back to what you're talking about.
I think it does. I think developers at some stage decided it was feature complete and therefore kind of walked away from things, which is fine in some regards, but when you're dealing with a desktop environment and changes do happen and do come along the line, I mean, we've got Wayland coming along. Now, unless someone does pick it up and run with it, and as I said, it looks from GitHub as if someone is doing that, this would cease working in a couple of years' time when Wayland's default desktop.
Yeah, there are things that are changing which they didn't expect, and they will always be changing in the Linux world.
Yeah, and there's a similar feeling with JWM, isn't there? That it's the developers think it's feature complete and don't really feel like working that much more on it.
Well, I don't know if the eponymous Joe, who's the maintainer of JWM, considers it feature complete or not. I mean, the amount of time I spent with JWM, it does a hell of a lot more than we've talked about on the show, and it really is worth exploring in depth. So I would guess, from my point of view, it really is, near as damn it, feature complete. I guess it's fairly telling that the developer, rather than adding new features, has decided to go in a different direction and is looking to replace the XML configuration files that Jesse was berating slightly earlier with a Lisp-based system, which seems a little bizarre, to be honest, because at least everyone can read XML and knows how to deal with it, whereas Lisp is kind of a different beast altogether.
Does this sound like change for change's sake?
I've got to be frank, to me it does. I mean, I can see his point of view reading what he's written on his website, but for your average user, I don't really see it as a step forward, to be honest. But anyway, we'll just have to keep an eye on that and see how it develops. So should we park ISWM and JWM for now and just talk about EDE?
Yeah, now this, instead of just being a simple apt-get install on Xubuntu, the only way for me to check it out without compiling it, which I just didn't have time to mess around with, was to use a live CD that's based on Ubuntu 12.04. So the one that I was using was a little bit behind the times. Now, you compiled it, Paddy, didn't you? So is it any different?
I did. Yeah, I compiled all three of these. I think you get a fair representation of where things are with EDE using the live RemasterSys CD.
Okay, because for me, it was a nice layout. Again, just everything XP-like. I mean, that's obviously why we're looking at it. And clicking the clock brings up a calendar by default, which was nice. And the theme was, I initially thought a lot nicer, but then as I used it a bit more, I thought, well, a bit nicer than ICE and JWM. And it seemed a little bit more XP-like, so perhaps a bit more fitting for an XP refugee.
Yeah, I agree. It had a definite XP theme, as did the other ones. And I also thought it looked a lot better at startup. It almost had a flat look, which is quite on trend at the moment, but I'm not sure if that was on purpose or not. I compiled it, and I found it quite a headache to get all of the various installation requirements up to speed. But eventually, when I get in, there was no mouse to start with, which was a bit confusing up until I kept on right-clicking to see where the mouse was as I moved around the screen, and then eventually got to opening Firefox that way. And once Firefox loaded, it spurred into life and I had a mouse again, so used it from there. But it was elegant, I would say, more elegant than the other two, for example.
I think it's a lot more approachable than the other two, simply because it does things like auto menu population instantly when you're installing software, and it's a lot more familiar without tweaking. It just comes out of the box, and there's very little configuration actually available within it at the moment.
As I said, I installed all of these on top of Mint 17, and this one compiled on top, and the start menu, if you will, had most of the applications that I have in Mint already there, whereas only ISWM had a couple, which I feel was more through pre-installed examples than actually populating, and JWM had absolutely nothing. So it was certainly one that I could get running with a lot more quickly.
Yeah, I actually had a look in the source code to see whether it was being reliant on, because I was running it on top of Debian, so I just wondered if it was the Debian menu system doing the population. But it's not. It's actually doing it itself, which partly explains, it's little features like that that explain why it's so much heavier than the other two. I mean, it's currently getting close towards LXDE weight-wise. Partly the features, that is, and partly the fact it's using PECWM as a window manager. So it isn't doing the whole lot itself, whereas the other two are.
Well, we found out a little bit more about it when we spoke to the developer. So let's have a listen to that now. So we're now joined by Sanal Zukan, who was a developer on the Fastlight Toolkit project, who now works on the Equinox Desktop Environment, EDE, project. So thanks for joining us, Sanal.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Sanal.
Hi, Sanal.
Hi.
If we can, let's start with FLTK, or as it's sometimes referred to as Fulltick. Can you tell us a little bit about that project, what it is, when it started, what the goals of the project are, and so on?
Yes, I will tell you the details what I'm aware of. The project started actually by the guy whose name is Bill Spitzak. The project started in the movie industry because the guy is working on porting, if I can recall correctly, a library named Forms, which is done in C, and was a kind of a way to easy write GUI application under X server. Mm-hmm. I think, I'm not sure about exact history, but the license permit didn't give him enough freedom to port it to another operating system, so he wrote it from scratch. Also, there is software called Nuke, which is used in a couple of famous movie projects like Titanic or King Kong or things like that, which is done by using Fulltick library. Unfortunately, later, you know, some companies after both license and things like that rewrote it in Qt, and the guy who wrote it went to work other things. I'm not sure what's happening. So the major goal behind that project is to provide a portable user interface toolkit, which is fast, which is easy also to work with, and is also in C++, which gives you a nice object-oriented approach for adding widgets and things like that. So comparing to other alternatives like GTK or Qt, it's much smaller, lightweight. You won't find things like built-in web browser or things like that. You know, it's designed just to quickly create interfaces without sacrificing speed and resources.
Yeah, it's just the GUI side of things, isn't it, that it looks after?
Yes.
Okay, and you mentioned licensing there. Just for the benefit of the audience, I should point out that it's currently licensed under the Lesser General Public License.
Definitely, with exception, because it gives you an option to freely link statically for commercial projects, and in that case, LGPL license does not apply. You can; it's much more liberal in that case. Mm-hmm. So, because of that, it's primarily designed to be statically linked. You know, and many commercial projects which still is still statically linked Fulltick library with the final binary for that. But if you want to design new widgets and things like that, full LGPL license is applied on them.
You mentioned some specialist software there. Are there any familiar applications that typical Linux users will have come across that are actually written in or linked with Fulltick?
Do you know about Dilog web browser?
Yep.
Yeah, so Dilog web browser is one of them, which is wrote in Fulltick. Well, very good question. Beside EDE, a TinyCore Linux. Have you tried to use it before?
Yes. A lot of their homebrewed tools are written in Fulltick, aren't they?
TinyCore Linux is, they wrote each of their tools in Fulltick library because, you know, it's small and things like that. So beside that, you know, I'm not sure among other popular toolkits because unfortunately Qt is quite popular these days. So many people are trying to write everything as possible.
Moving on to the Equinox desktop environment. Can you explain what prompted the start of the EED project and how and when you got involved?
Well, the project was started with an idea to create a desktop environment which is powered with Fulltick library. Initially, when it started, I wasn't part of the team. The original team were actually Fulltick developers, and they In that time when they started the project, KDE became a little bit successful because they promoted Qt library. GNOME also became a bit famous and they promoted JTK library and things like that. So they started that. After a couple of years, those guys simply disappeared. I discovered the project because, you know, I found Fultic library by accident. Because, you know, I was developing my own game engine and things like that. You know, when you start to learning development, you go and try to write your own game and things like that. Uh-huh. And I needed some library, user GUI library to create, you know, my maps and things like that. And I found Fultic. I was quite amazed because it's quite easy to learn and to use it. So, you know, I immediately started to work with it. And after that, someone mentioned me about Equinox Desktop. Unfortunately, none of those guys were present out there. So, you know, I started to send some patches. Some of them would reply, apply patches. You know how it's going on in open source world. And after, at some point, you know, some of them gave me just read-write access to repository and gave me all needed details to start project maintenance. And after that, I never heard from them. I'm not sure what's happening to them. Yeah. So I tried to mail them a couple of times and ask them about, you know, it's quite nice to ask original developers about, you know, if you want to change, you know, if you want to migrate from Subversion to Git, or if you want to change logo or things like that. But unfortunately, they never replied. So now the project is, you know, self-sustained, it's basically.
Can you tell us a bit about the history of the project and how its use of Fultic has changed between versions 1 and 2 of EED?
Oh, yeah, the history is quite interesting out there, because initially the project was started with a Fultic fork called Extended Fultic. The guys tried to add a new set of widgets, tried to apply their own ideas how the library should work, should look like, and things like that. There is quite curious history about Fultic library. There are two versions called version 1 and version 2, you know. Currently is using still version 1, but the original Fultic author decided to rewrite everything from scratch, and his rewrite he was actually doing rewrite for, I cannot remember, maybe 7-8 years. He wrote everything from scratch, he designed new API, everything looks really nice, but no one used it. You know, he totally changed API, and people who would like to contribute, you know, they have their own software, have their own products, and they just would like to migrate without any interruptions and things like that. So, unfortunately, that library was abandoned. We ended up maintaining that called Extended Fultic library, which is another fork of that Fultic library version 2. And original Equinox was written using that Extended Fultic library. At some point, we decided, you know, because Equinox development were always small team, you know, there is always one or two, maximum three person who is doing something, and working on desktop alone is extremely complex these days, especially if you need to maintain a GUI library alongside that. So we decided to abandon that. We went to Fultic library version 2 because Fultic developers assured us that library will come out soon. And after we rewrote everything in Fultic version 2, you know, we simply noticed that, you know, Fultic version 2 is going nowhere. So they simply abandoned that. So we rewrote again in Fultic version 1, and that is the final rewrite I'm hoping to be done. So actually we rewrote it 3 times up till now. So after that rewrote, you know, we noticed people are more interested in library because no one is interested to install additional libraries. No one is maintaining. The distribution doesn't like to introduce libraries, duplicate libraries. You know, if you have a full tick library, if you have some extension that is libraries on its own, no one is interested in that. So it's much easier to distribute these days and to work with, because, you know, a lot of people knows full tick library itself. So it's much easier to contribute.
Obviously, several competitors in the lightweight desktop market. How would you compare where EDE stands today against projects like ICE Window Manager and Joe's Window Manager?
Between ICE Window Manager and which one? I didn't hear you.
JWM, Joe's Window Manager.
I didn't use that, but I used ICE WVM. So I will just compare these two. ICE WVM is quite nice window manager, but it's just window manager on its own. And by some sort of definition, you know, desktop environment, it's on a bit higher level than window manager and so on. Modern desktop environment, it's actually expected quite a lot from modern desktop environment. You know, you have to have DBus support, you have to have some kind of notification support. Besides, you are having own window manager. So
yeah.
ICE WM, just plain window manager. It doesn't have support for DBus, doesn't have support for sort of extending it. We are, you know, some additional libraries and things like that. So that's the basics.
I mean, EDE is slightly heavier on the memory side of things than something like ICE. And I guess that's down to the functionality you've mentioned. And having compiled it myself, I also noticed you're using PEC Window Manager at the moment. Is that the intention to stick with that, or are you planning to write a complete window manager in the same toolkit?
Yes, yes. So the plan is to rewrite it from scratch in FLTK library. I chose PEC WM simply because it was quite convenient in that time. There is no much requirements, additional requirements besides X library to be compiled, to be used. So, you know, I simply included it because it's done in C++, no additional dependencies, so it's quite easy to distribute. Unfortunately, PEC-WM is not quite maintained window manager. So there is a couple of patches I had to I had to fix a couple of issues with it to integrate it with desktop and things like that. So the final plan is to replace it in the near future with own window manager.
Okay, Sanal, you've told us about the colourful history of the EDE. I'm wondering what developments you have planned for the future of the project.
Small incremental development, frequent releases, because you know, in the past we had you know, yearly releases, and it's not beneficial for the project to have that large span between each version. So I'm hoping to bring faster releases with small number of changes, so people will be much easier to notice. After that, the plan is to add a file manager. There is some patches from the guys who worked before on the project. There is unfinished file manager done in Fultic, so I need to sort out the things and clean up the code, and also to replace the window manager. So for now, that's it. In far future, I'm planning to see what's happening in Wayland land, because that is quite popular thing these days.
It is, yeah, yeah.
Yes, but you know, I don't see any concrete progress from there. You know, I'm just seeing those guys are speaking about Wayland, how it's cool, how it should replace everything, but I don't see anyone done anything exactly with it, except, you know, just saying that they support Wayland.
What about Mia though, eh? You gonna support that?
Yeah, well, I'm not Ubuntu user, you know, so I'm just relying on patches people send it to me, but you know, I'm open for you know, new features and things like that.
And do you see a final goal where you consider this project finished, or do you think it will continue
Well, no project is finished. I don't know any project out there that is finished unless developers abandon it. But there is always tiny things that you can fix, you can change. But I'm not planning to change a lot of things out there because I'm kind of old school user. You know, I'm relying a lot of taskbar on plain window manager. I'm not a fan of modern way how window manager should look like tiling window manager and things like that. You know, people like that. I'm not a fan of that. Also, I'm using, I'm quite, how to say, heavy user of my own desktop because I'm using daily on my job and things like that. So I'm not keen to break everything, to start everything from scratch. You know, I'm quite reliant on it. So maybe also to answer that question, maybe in future to add more scripting support inside desktop because I'm not seeing that it's quite popular option in modern desktop environments. You know, I'm Emacs user and I like ability of Emacs to change everything in it. So it would be nice to have that option in desktop too, you know.
So are you looking for any additional help with work on the project?
Definitely. I'm always open to new help, to new contribution, translations, art, everything of that, as long as it's within the project goals.
Okay. And what about distro packaging? I mean, it's not in Debian, for example, and it would be good for us if it was.
Officially, I'm not sure it's Debian because someone recently created Debian packages for it, and there is Debian packages for previous version. I'm not sure it's not included, but I think someone mentioned me before that the reason why they didn't include it because they already have ED package. It's kind of Emacs development extension or environment, things like that. So someone asked them indirectly, actually, not directly, to change name, which, you know, it's impossible in this case. But I had, I had bad experience with Ubuntu guys. They pinged me a couple of times to change the way how libraries are linked in compilation phase of desktop, and I try to explain them how, you know, these days it's quite modern to explicitly link everything, and they decided to change how Fultic library is linked. You know, Fultic library is coming with a tool called FLTK config, and I'm using that to pull all linking dependencies Fultic is relying on, and they changed that. And I asked them to just revert that back to original state, how developers is distributing the library, and they refuse that. So, you know, hopefully someone will fix that in the future.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been really interesting to hear about the project.
Thank you for giving me a chance.
Thanks, Sanal.
Thank you very much.
So I think it's fairly clear from our conversation with Sanal that EDE is a bit of a different beast from ISWM or JWM in that it's designed to be a lot simpler to use without manual configuration, file editing, and basically giving you the look and feel that a Windows user would be more familiar with.
Yeah, it does definitely feel further on than the other two, but still not quite complete. And obviously he's got a lot of hard work to do on it, and hopefully he'll find some other people to help out with it. And it's definitely something we're going to keep an eye on. So with that, we're coming to the end of another Linux Luddites. You can email us at show@linuxluddites.com, find us on Twitter, Linux Luddites, or leave a comment on our website. Thanks for joining me, Paddy and Jesse, and thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you again in 2 weeks for more Linux news, reviews, comment, and generally being grumpy.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks all. Bye.
See you later.